Why don't we go ahead and get started? Hope everybody had a good weekend. Our council member, our judge, and our pastor, can we call on you for an invocation? I think you're up. Please rise. So, Mr. Allen, could you start with the Pledge of Allegiance after we're done with the invocation?
Gracious God, God of the universe, but God of each and every one of us personally, God who knows each of us by name, once again, God, we come before you humble and bowed, asking your choicest blessings upon this our gathering today. Lord, we give you thanks that you have allowed us to come by here one more time. And so, God, as we begin this day's business, I lift to you every person under the sound of my voice. And I ask you, God, to strengthen each of us where we may be weak. Lift us up where we may be torn down. Infuse rest in our bodies and give us kingdom wisdom to do our business and the city's business this day. Amen.
Amen.
Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in pledge allegiance to the flag.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Well, again, good morning, everyone. Today is continuing in the budget workshop and the briefings. There's a number of briefings that are scheduled. We might as well jump right to it. Mary, do you want to give kind of an overview?
No, we're just going to look at some of the issues that you requested. We look at in preparation for the budget. And Eric, are you stormwater today? Good.
And then maybe after this, Mary, we'll do that. But you can give us kind of an overview of any other briefings that were requested and where that's going to be kind of their additional report.
Terrific. How are you doing? Good morning. I'm Eric Thompson, Assistant Director in Public Works and Transportation. And over the next 10 or 15 minutes, I'd like to give you an executive overview of the stormwater utility fee study and how that impacts the proposed budget for next year. On slide 3, we cover some of the two primary uses or responsibilities of the utility. One is to maintain our drainage system, and then secondly, we are responsible for compliance with a number of state and federal regulations. Some of the examples of some of the expenses that the utility incurs in the maintenance area are levee maintenance. In order to have an environment downtown, we need to have levees that are well-maintained and protected. We also conduct alley drainage and curb and gutter repair. There's also some debt service and mowing and litter type operations. Similarly, we have some compliance responsibilities. We spend at least $5 million annually on the stormwater management program. That includes storm surface water monitoring, a number of compliance inspections. On any given month, we probably conduct in excess of 700 different types of facility inspections. A fairly extensive public outreach program, and then general pollution prevention through our website. An average of 125 public events each year with school children, adults, through various media. In addition, we also have spill response. Anytime you see a large tanker that's overturned on the interstate or on a city street, chances are our fire department responds, and some of those expenses are also recouped or covered by the utility. This utility has been in existence for approximately 17 years, and we've adjusted rates 4 times, as noted. Appendix D includes more details on the previous rate changes. For the next few minutes, I'd like to talk a little about how the utility actually works. Basically, all real property in the city, unless otherwise exempted through a state or local ordinance, is billed on a monthly basis. That's through the Pay-One Unified Billing System. There's a line item for the called stormwater charges, and then we also, on the monthly bill, explain what that fee is used for. Current year, the revenue projection is $29.4 million, and it's broken into our three major property categories. First being residential lots. These are based on the size, the gross size of the lot. So the larger your property, the more your monthly fee is. And that generates approximately 4 to 5% of our current revenue. Next, we have commercial properties. These are billed somewhat differently, and it's based on per 100 square feet of impervious area. And I'll talk a little more about impervious area in just a second. I would like to note that there is no maximum charge on the commercial lot billing, so that's an excellent error on that slide. And commercial accounts represent about 52% of the revenue for the current year. And our third and final category would be vacant lots. Again, billed similarly to the commercial properties based on each 100 square feet of impervious area. One difference here with the vacant properties is that there's a cap. Currently, the most that any vacant property would pay is $20.51 per month. And that's based on a cap threshold of 1.4 acres. So any property larger than 1.4 acres pays the $20.51 per month. And that generates roughly 3% of the revenue. All the rain that falls on Dallas at some point makes its way to the Trinity, with the exception of that that is absorbed by the ground or taken up by plants, etc. The runoff, or the surface runoff, is the one that the utility is most concerned with. That rock water makes its way eventually to the drainage system that the city maintains, which is what the utility was established to fund. So if you take your general residential neighborhood, the more impervious your lot, the more hard surfaces you have, if you will, the more runoff will be conveyed to the system, and the higher your monthly fee in general. And then we have three different types of property, vacant, residential, and commercial, starting with the least impervious. We'll look at the vacant property, three example, three-quarter acre lots. The first currently pays $10.38 per month. A residential property with it's a little more impervious right now actually pays a little less, $10.16 per month. And then a more developed commercial property would pay just over $23 per month. And these are under the current rates in effect right now. I like to compare a couple of different vacant pieces of property. On the left, you see a 1.4 acre tract, and on the right, there's a property that's 140 acres. So 100 times the size, which would generate 100 times more runoff to be dealt with by our system. That property on the left currently pays $19.37 per month. And the larger, much larger property on the right pays roughly a dollar more per month. And this is one of the things that the study identified that we wanted to address. So, in accordance with the city adopted financial management criteria, periodically we need to assess all fees that the city charges and how appropriate they are. And this was our year to do that. And we primarily do that through basically a cost of service type analysis. We look at all the eligible costs, compare those to the current revenue, and then we try to, as equitably as possible, distribute those costs across all the account holders. So, study results and recommendations. We start with the vacant property. Right now we have this arbitrarily, somewhat arbitrarily, established 1.4 acre threshold for the vacant land, so anything greater than 1.4 acres pays the same flat fee of $20.51 per month right now. Through some of the statistical analysis of vacant properties in the city, we recommend that where we identify that that threshold is probably too low and that we're foregoing revenue because of that. So the recommendation with respect to vacant land is to increase that threshold from 1.4 acres to 5 acres. In general, there are costs that the city incurs that aren't being borne by the utility. We'd like to correct that by capturing about $4 million plus in the utility costs that are currently borne by the general fund. Some of the fees for the commercial and vacant land are all based on runoff coefficients. We want to optimize those to some degree, so there's a number of coefficient changes that are listed in Appendix B. And then in general, revenue did not appear to be equitable across account classes. In a nutshell, the residential account payers made up a disproportionate amount of the revenue. So we want to adjust that by taking a look at our rate structure to restore a balance there. Ideally, we would have a normal distribution, somewhat of a bell-shaped curve of the distribution of residential properties. So these charts, the upper left in blue, the size of the property increases from left to right. And currently, that's not exactly a uniform distribution. The lower right chart, the lower right hand chart is
While we're taking a break for just a moment, I want to recognize Mr. Ed Palmer. Mr. Palmer, thanks for being with us. Mr. Palmer serves on the library board, and we appreciate all the efforts that you put in there. It sounds like good things are happening at the library. Terrific. Good. Keep up the good work. I know I think Suzanne's supposed to be able to later, too, we'll recognize her. Hey, terrific. Terrific. Thank you. Well, why don't we go ahead and get back to the briefing now. Sorry to have interrupted you for just a moment, but go ahead. I think you're on page 15.
Sure. So in the lower right-hand corner, you see a graphic that indicates that with proposed changes, we'll get much closer to a normal distribution, at least from Tier 2 and forward, which is about where our median-sized property falls. Slide 16, this is the current rate structure. So from the fees range from $250 per month down to $1,963 in the residential classes, and then the unit rate of about 8 cents a 100 square feet on the commercial and vacant. Slide 17, these are the proposed rates. And it's really important to point out that the first four tiers in the residential classes won't see an increase in their monthly fee. And that's about 86% or more of our current accounts, which total 278,000 actually. The fifth or the largest residential tier, down at the bottom of the residential area, will see a moderate increase to 4306 per month. The unit rate for residential or non-residential and vacant land will also increase from just under 8 cents per hundred to 1031 per hundred. And again, 86.5% of all of our account holders won't see an increase based on these proposed changes. Something else to note is that residential rates in the proposed structure are based on impervious area as opposed to just gross residential area as they were in the past or currently. And then we also want to note that we increase or propose an increase in the vacant land cap from 1.4 acres to 5 acres. So if we look at those same three-quarter acre lots with the old and new fee structures, we're a little more in line with the goal here. Before, the vacant property paid a little more than the residential, even though there was, in theory, less runoff from that property. With these proposed changes, we restore that equity so that the fees increase to the right. So vacant, least impervious, has the lowest, and the commercial, of course, higher. And in summary, four main points. We're trying to make the utility whole. We've identified at least $4 million in costs that could have been borne by the utility previously, so we want to make that happen. We're going to maintain rates for over 86% of all the account holders. Our average monthly residential fee with these proposed changes would increase from $4.58 per month to $5.20, which if you look in slide 32, compares us to a number of other cities, and we're certainly not the lowest, but definitely not the highest by any stretch. And then we want to implement modest increases in the non-residential accounts. There are 22,800 odd commercial properties in the billing system right now, and this would equate to about $24 or less per month on average for those 22,000 accounts.
Just last week.
Having budget public hearings this month and next, budget adoption later in September, and then the change will take effect October 1st. And if I could go to 32 really quick, this is that benchmarking of our fees, current and proposed, versus some of the other cities. If you take a look at Austin, they're probably three-quarters of the way to the right. Their average monthly fee right now is $7.15 per month. San Antonio on the far left at about $2.50. Fort Worth and Arlington at $3.75 right now, and they're also contemplating changes to their fees as well. And with that, I'll be happy to answer any questions you might have.
I think the most critical thing to remember in this presentation is that this is as much a reallocation of these costs and fees as it is anything else, and that almost 86% of our people will not be having an impact. Folks with normal size residential lots will not experience this increase.
Yes, sir. Thank you. I have very limited knowledge and understanding of this, so this is a steep learning curve for me, and I've been asking some questions of Ms. Koop, who's our chair of Environment and Transportation. Question for the manager. On page 5, it references $2.2 million for spill response cleanup and $1.5 for city facility housekeeping. Are we making an effort to assess the costs incurred by those that spill, or are we reallocating this cost to everyone?
The whole point of this, and if you'd go back to the first page of your presentation, please, Eric, our stormwater utility is to keep the water that runs off of all of our surfaces into our lakes and rivers and streams clean, and that is responsibility by federal law that we have, so that when our facilities have spills on the asphalt or in areas that runoff carries it into the stormwater system, we have to clean it up, and that keeps it from happening into the system.
Absolutely agree, and I think we should. But my question is, shouldn't the person or entity or business that spills pay the cost? Why are we reallocating the cost? Is there an effort to make sure that we go after the individuals that are spilling and creating the pollution?
Yes, we do some of that, but we have to clean it up, and so it's going to have to be paid for. Yes.
There's no doubt that we have to clean it up. What I fear is we keep passing on costs, and we don't. I mean, this is a full cost recovery effort, correct?
That's what we're trying to do. Yes.
If it's a full cost recovery effort, it would make sense also to make sure that the entity that's creating the mess, that's creating the pollution, that's creating the cost, we should go after that person. And I'd be interested in knowing what specifically the manager's doing in order to address that issue. Because it's not an answer long term, it's to keep increasing the cost to everyone. I know that in my small business, now I'm going to go back to my office this afternoon and look at the stormwater fee, but it keeps going up over and over. And I absolutely don't want to be unfair to our residential payers, but I also don't want to be unfair to the businesses that we depend on for jobs and our tax base. So I'm concerned on dual funds.
I hear you.
What is it that we are doing specifically? I'm looking at page 5. What are we doing specifically to address the issue of who's spilling?
We go after the people that we can identify the spill with, but additionally, the charges to your property are, with this study, are assessed in such a way as to what part of the expense you should be bearing appropriately based on the surface of your property. And Ramon, you may want to add some detail to that.
Without a doubt, our charge is to pursue those who cause the city to incur additional cost as a result of spillage. But I think the key thing here is that you've got a significant amount of ongoing expenses that are being distributed as it relates to this study where costs are incurred. So the vast majority, you can see on page 5, the spill response and cleanup is about $2.2 million of the entire total.
What's the total?
$36.8 million.
Where does that call that? And I apologize for not seeing that. Where in here is it to look at total expenses and a breakdown of how we're spending that $36 million or whatever you quoted?
I don't think we shared with you the total expense, although in the early part of the briefing there's a breakout of the activities that are covered by the utility.
And you guys keep saying utility. This is not Dallas Water Utility.
No, this is a stormwater utility.
Stormwater utility. So it's separate from Public Works and Transportation?
Right, absolutely. It's under their management. Now, Tom also goes after people that we need. If we can't collect, then Tom goes after for collection, actually,
well,
too.
I'm interested in what the... If it's a $36 million entity, okay, out of $2.7 billion budget, it's a small amount of money. But still $36 million, and people are going to get hit with increases. And so I'm sensitive to that. So I would be interested in what this pro forma budget is, or that it's not in the presentation, the $36
million. Okay.
I'm interested in the success rate, I'll put it in the positive, the success rate of our collection efforts for individuals that create these costs.
Okay.
Now, if it's fixed costs that aren't relative to these type of things, I understand. But I'm interested in how successful we are, because that's where our energy should be spent. The people that are polluting should be the ones paying the freight. Thank you.
And we'll get you that information.
Thank you, Mayor. On the remainder out of your spill response and housekeeping effort, you've got like $33 million in the budget. Okay. So, I mean, I can see where if you have a business and you have more impervious surface, then obviously you can have cars probably parked on that impervious surface, a lot of it, and the runoff from that, oil, gasoline, so on and so forth, that's what's causing a lot of the pollution. And so I understand that part of it. But the one part kind of I don't understand is on page 33, and maybe I just don't have enough information, but on something like a golf course where it's privately owned and you know that they're putting pesticides and fertilizers on it, and you know that's causing, even though they have a pervious surface, and most of it's pervious, a lot of it is going right straight into the into our rivers and into our stormwater and so on and so forth. So how do we justify that the proposed runoff coefficient is lower than a parking lot when you know that they're putting pesticides and fertilizers on the
and not to be argumentative, Ms. Coop, but the basis for the fee is not on pollution, it's on runoff, on how much runoff is generated.
Right. And so, but do you understand what I'm trying to get at?
Yes, I do.
What I'm trying to get at is a correlation between us polluting the streams in our rivers and even into our stormwater system, and perhaps an industry that probably puts a lot of pesticides and stuff into our system. So I understand what you're saying. I do understand what you're saying. I'm just wondering if there could be, if maybe we should have some fresh eyes look at that in the future to think about how that affects our water system.
Absolutely, and I think quite frankly that as the business and the utility matures, that you'll see us move more and more toward focus on the quality issue. But if I might take you back to the early pages of the briefing, beginning on page 3, if I'm not mistaken, if you'll see where our expenses are today related to the utility, they're really focused principally on the quantity issue. And from the onset, when the utility was established, the fee looks at or is driven by, if you will, the amount of runoff that is produced by each site. So we're still focused there, but I think you're right. I think as we become more and more sophisticated with regards to how we treat stormwater, I think you're going to see the fee be influenced more and more by the type of runoff, the quality of the runoff that you produce.
You know, I know T.I. prides himself on putting cleaner water back into the system than they got to begin with. And I just want our industry to start thinking about the type of water that they put back into the system. I'm not just picking on golf courses. I'm sure there's other industries as well. So I'd like to, at some point, maybe in the next 6 months or so, bring that to the Transportation and Environment Committee, some kind of just long-range look at how we're going to address various pollutants that are put into our water by our users, and perhaps just an education campaign would help. But I think now is the time probably to do that kind of thing. And I do think that it ends up costing us more money in the end, separating. Because when you have, the EPA is going to end up probably changing some of their standards for water quality and arsenic and so on and so forth, and so, you know, that's going to increase your cost.
Ms. Coop, I do want to remind the council.
I understand the separation.
This is stormwater, and fortunately in Dallas, unlike many other cities in the Northeast, we have a separate stormwater and a wastewater system, collection system. So at this point, we're doing very little, if any, in the way of treating the stormwater from a quality standpoint.
Somebody is.
But I think ultimately we will be moving in that direction.
Okay. It's an environmental issue. I understand what you're saying. You're looking at it from a business issue. I'm looking at it from an environmental issue, and we definitely need to do more about that. So I'm not giving up on my point.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
Well taken.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Coop. Appreciate it. Mr. Ackman, please.
Thank you, Mayor. Ramon, on page 14. Good morning.
Good morning.
The study and recommendation, what year was the study done?
The study was just completed, Ms. Rackins.
When did it start?
It was started this past spring. It's been just the last few months. The council authorized us to hire somebody to review the rates and make recommendations, and the single most significant recommendation has to do with the issue of the cap that we arbitrarily placed way back when we first enacted the utility on the residential lots.
Okay. When was the last study? Did we do one before then?
Mr. Atkins, I think that periodically we have internally looked at the rate. I don't think we have done a full-blown study like we did this time in a number of years. The last time that the fee was increased was 4 years ago, and I think that was done without the benefits of an outside study.
What I was getting at is, number one, if we did it, which we didn't, your answer is that we did not do one, a full-blown study 4 years ago, so now we just now find out now what the rate increase should be with the last, with this result, right, of this study.
Well, this study has recommended a realignment of the rates, which would result in additional revenues to cover legitimate expenses associated with managing the utility.
Okay, so is it fair to say that 4 years ago we did not recognize that we need to increase the rate? Today we do recognize that we need to increase the rate. And I just wonder why we did not catch it with that time period.
We have known, Mr. Atkins, that there were additional legitimate expenses that were being carried in the general fund that were not being covered by the stormwater utility.
And my question is, I guess, manager, that if you knew that, why now? Why didn't we not go, you know,
well,
2 years ago and kind of ease up to it and then all of a sudden, boom?
Well, for one thing, the cost would have been cheaper several years ago. The increasing cost in gasoline has driven some of this. Additionally, we're more redistributing these costs than we are increasing. We are, some have increased, but again, 85% of our customers will not see a change in their rates on these. So most people will not see a change in their rates. And yes, we could do it. You know, we could have done it another way, just did not.
Could you go to the chart, the resident rate, the 5.20 versus the 4.5 it compared to the other cities? It's not done yet. Okay, so we're saying that a resident rate is going up from 4.58 to 5.2. That's the proposed budget, is that correct?
Yes, sir. But if you will allow me, Mr. Atkins, remember that nearly 90% of residential customers will see no increase. There's a significant, nearly 90%. There's a significant impact on the larger parcels, but there is no impact on the vast majority of our residential customers, 90%.
What about, just say you have a small business, would they see a large increase or what? I mean, is there a determination between a small business and a large business? Is there a separation between small and large?
No, sir. Chances are, if you're a small business on less than an acre, you might actually see a decrease, because there's also a corresponding decrease in the runoff coefficient. So even though the unit rate increased, because of that coefficient change, you might have a smaller bill come October than you have today.
Thank you. That's all, ma'am.
Thank you, Mr. Atkins. Ms. Cadane, did you have anything? Okay. Ms. Davis and then Mr. Dempsey.
Thank you, Ms. Leffert. I'm on page 20, on page 23, and I'm looking at the comparison of other city, and right now we're at $48.45. Then we propose $51.41. That's not an increase? On page 23. I'm on the chart.
Ms. Davis, that's the next briefing.
The next briefing, yeah. Oh, okay. And this one here is on the, okay, what page is that? I'll wait to the next one. Well, I'll wait to the next one, okay.
Mr. Tipke, please.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Well, either Eric or Ramon, let's try Eric. Why do we do the fees on a grouping basis? Is it just a matter of simplicity when we know the square footage of individual lots?
Actually, that's one of the enhancements, from my opinion, with the proposed changes. Right now, the fees are based solely on the residential side, on
right.
the gross size of the lot.
Right.
And one of the changes we're making, somewhat subtly, on 17, you'll see that we are looking at impervious area now, which actually makes it a little cleaner to attribute costs to where.
Right. I guess my question is, though, but you've got it 9,000 to 20,000, 20,000 to 40. My question is, when we know the square footage of the properties, why don't we just assess it on a per square foot basis? Is it just a matter of, you know, X per square foot, or is it just easier for us to do it in groupings like this where we've got four fees and somebody just fits in there?
It's easier accounting. Some cities will have one residential rate no matter what the size of your property. We think this gives you a better assignment of the cost to
right.
where
so it wouldn't be any better to subdivide it down to so much per square foot?
Six in one hand, half dozen.
Okay, next question. Go to the slide where you had, well, where we currently are. I mean, what you're proposing is to reduce the fee on vacant residential. I mean, vacant commercial.
No, sir, that unit rate.
Right, with the no, it's the horizontal chart there. I don't know which one.
32.
Nope. Anyway, you're lowering the fee on vacant land, and my question is, why does vacant land have less runoff than a residential lot with a house on it? If you're not talking about sewage, you're talking about just runoff. So if rain falls on it, it would seem, unless I'm missing something, that the with no improvements, no landscaping, no grass or anything to absorb on just truly vacant land, that the runoff potentially would be larger on vacant land than on residential occupied land.
In theory, the vegetation, trees, if you will, on that vacant land might actually help absorb more and reduce the amount that runs off.
What if it doesn't have any trees?
Well, depending on soil types and...
I mean, most of the vacant land I go by looks like it's just, you know, scraped and bare. And it would seem to me that that's the land that we really have the most runoff. All right. I'm sorry to ask such out-of-the-box questions, but anyway. Back to Ms. Coops. There's no answer for that one. Just file that away for future briefings. The golf course issue. Is a golf course developed land, or is a golf course undeveloped land?
It's developed land.
It's developed land. Okay. Which leads me to my next question. We continually try to educate the citizens to not put things down the stormwater system under the auspices that, you know, if you put it down there, it ends up in the river and, you know, flows down to Houston, they get to drink our dirty stuff. But why have we not, I mean, is it just a matter of cost? Or, I mean, are we waiting for the government to come to say, we're going to give you some standards for stormwater? And are we waiting for that, or why are we not doing anything? Because if the city is not cleaning it, if it's just letting it run down, there's really not a lot of marketing motivation for citizens to get them to not put their stuff in there.
And on the contrary, we actually expend a lot of effort and resources now to educate golf courses and other targeted...
Well, not just golf courses, I'm talking about...
And other targeted industrial property types.
Non-industrial.
There are some water quality standards in place now from the state and from the federal government. We're in line with those and making strides every day to make sure we remain in compliance with those and identify those that are having an acute impact on our ability to remain in compliance. So the briefing I think will provide a lot more detail.
Right. Maybe I don't understand the difference between the answer you gave Ms. Coop in that we're not required to clean it now. I mean, I thought we were, but when I heard you say that, that's why I'm asking the question.
I think, quite frankly, basically, Mr. Natinsky, is the fact that the city isn't incurring cost in terms of treating that effluent or treating that runoff. And so we haven't yet gotten to the point where we can begin to assess a cost and legitimately be able to claim that we're incurring that cost in terms of treating that runoff.
Okay, I follow that. So we're not incurring a cost, which sends the message to me, unless I'm not understanding what you're saying, is that we don't do anything.
Well, I beg to differ.
Wait a minute. Because if we did something, then there ought to be a cost involved with it.
And I think Eric has identified for you what we're trying to do is prevent, educate, and we have enforcement activities to make sure that commercial and other entities are in compliance. But we are not yet treating that runoff.
Are we recapturing our cost?
Absolutely.
The enforcement action.
Absolutely, and in fact, that's what this study does, is make recommendations with regards to recovering all costs associated both with enforcement and the other activities that the city incurs.
Okay. And go to page 32 for my last question. What does a city like Portland, Sacramento, Philadelphia, the three to the right, what do they do? Are they under some different auspices? Do they have to clean it? What's the difference between, you know, most of the other cities until you start getting over to Charlotte, you know, or Denver, then all of a sudden they start going up. So what are they doing for $16 a month? I'm assuming that's a monthly fee, you know, or 14 or 12, that we're not doing. What's causing them to have to do it? I don't consider Portland, you know, a high cost of living, doing business city, so I'm wondering why the differential. And I'm not advocating that we raise it. I'm just trying to figure out, you know, is there something down the road that we're going to get hit with? Are we going to slide, you know, toward the right?
One might argue that Portland is far to the left of us on the scale of green cities.
Far to the left of us?
Well, not on the chart, but on the green
on the
scale.
Why don't we ask Portland and let's bring that information back, okay?
Well, yeah, if we don't know, then just tell me we don't know, but I think we ought to...
The reality is, Mr. Matinsky, that, for example, one might argue that all of our storm drainage capital improvement programs might be paid back to the stormwater utility fee. And if you wanted to do that, the debt payment, if you wanted to do that, that would put us way over on the right side of that chart.
So what's happening to the debt today?
Right now, all of the capital improvement programs associated with stormwater runoff are being paid for out of the general fund, debt service, much like our streets and other general government-type improvements.
You're saying if we wanted to turn it into a quasi...
A true utility and argue that the capital improvements associated with stormwater could also be funded out of this utility fee.
I think we ought to find out what those last three cities at least are doing just as a comparison, and so we kind of know where we fit in the world of the range of fees being, you know, being charged.
Will do.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you very much. Mr. Dancy, please.
Mr. Mayor, thank you. This does not sound like Mitchell Rosansky, but I see nothing wrong with where Mr. Thompson, first of all, I've read this. It's a very nice report, and thank you. 62 cents a month, and we have 86% of the home properties in Dallas are staying at a wash. That's a pun for this, staying at a wash.
86% of all parcels, will not be impacted.
So we're talking about, I wish we would spend this much time on getting our ad valorem taxes reduced and not spend all this time on 62 cents a month on this. Very good report. I do have some properties in other cities surrounding Dallas, and my stormwater fees are far more than what we're talking about. I have one comment, and Mr. Natinsky hit on it very lightly. We need to do an educational program in my district all over. It's unbelievable what people are putting in the storm inlets. Mr., you're shaking your head, Ramon. You won't believe it. We need to get some notices out to people needs to be in English and Spanish. There should be a fine for these people that are dumping. I think you once told me our stormwater ends up in Houston, doesn't it?
Ultimately, yes.
Our stormwater ends up ultimately in Houston for their drinking water. It goes to Lake Palestine, doesn't it? Some of our stormwater. Does it?
Livingston, I believe.
Yes. Okay. I didn't mean Palestine. I meant Livingston. So let me tell you, it would save us some money, but we've got to do either a stuffer in our waterworks. You know, it should be a fine on whoever sees somebody dumping or a homeowner. I mean, it's unbelievable what they dumped in there. And as Jill knows, which I complained to her one time, I called Jill and she got it taken care of. There were a couple of cement trucks that I saw, and Jill was shaking her head up and down. They were emptying their cement in our storm sewer. And I called, yes, Mayor, I see you. And I called Jill, and she's checked on it. They closed the darn inlet. And Jill, thank you. You really took care of that very quickly. I appreciate it. It flooded two businesses in the area. But let me tell you, I think this is, you need to think about an educational thing to get out to our people. We cannot dump in our stormwater. We just can't do it. Everything is in there. So I appreciate it. I'm going to support this. When I see 86% no increases, I just don't have a problem with 62 cents. I don't like any kind of increases, but I want to save everything I have to get our taxes down and just not 62 cents a month. Thank you for the good report. Thank you. Mr. Mayor, thank you.
Thank you. Good. Appreciate you being with us. Thank you. Water utilities? We'd like to recognize Suzanne Charter, who's the chairman of our library board. Suzanne, thanks for being with us. I mentioned Ed just a little bit ago. We appreciate all the work that's being done. Good things happen on the library fund, so we appreciate that. Why don't you just give a quick overview? Mary, just give a quick overview of where we're going to go, the issues that were raised.
Today we'll be finishing up with water utilities and the employee health benefits budget for the upcoming year. Also looking at the tax rate, legal options and responsibilities and decisions you have to make very shortly. Now, September 3rd, we will have a review of the streets department, police department, fire rescue, and the DFW Airport Board's budget. So that's what we'll be working on the next few weeks.
Terrific. Thank you. Jody Water?
Good morning. The briefing you have in front of you, I think, is behind your second tab. I want to go right to pages 4 and kind of take you back to August 11th when the manager presented her budget, where you can see our part of that budget is in the category of enterprise, these two blue boxes on the board. If you go to the next page, you can see the part of it that Water Utilities makes up of that. $511 million on an operating budget with a capital budget of $320 million. It's important to understand, too, that the debt service component the utility has to recover to fund that capital program is made up in that 511. So we go on to page 9. The management approach that we use in trying to manage this big utility. To remind you, we have over $2.9 billion in assets. You can see there on the top of that page of what that's made up of. Mostly you see the treatment plants as well as $1.1 billion and the wastewater pipeline system about 10,000 miles, about $1.3 billion. To give you a kind of order of magnitude, later in the briefing you see we have a 10-year capital program of over $3 billion. So we're at a point in the utility's life where it has aged and we're having to do major replacements and renovations as well as expansion for long-term growth. Again, here on this page, you'll see our financial management performance criteria that really has guided this utility for 20-some-odd years or longer that basically keeps it in pretty good standing. As you might recall, the bond rating got upgraded this year, and so that's something that that I think we can all be proud of. If I go to page 11, I want to show you the service area that we cover. Just to remind you, we serve the bulk of Dallas County and parts of Denton County, about 2.4 million people, as well as 2.4 million people included in that are our retail customers in the city of Dallas, our co-citizens. Our approach to the budget on page 13 was structured around kind of these flags, so to speak. We want to conserve our resources. We have to focus on environmental compliance. We are a highly regulated, highly compliant-driven operation, number of permits and so forth and so on. We have technology improvements that we think are important. Again, infrastructure-driven, as I mentioned, our assets are the big driving key for that. And another thing we've done in this budget is shifted toward leak detection and main rehabilitation with some of our FTEs. Going on page 15, I'm kind of going quickly, if that serves you guys well. Another driving factor here was the ongoing reduction in our gallons per capita per day. In other words, our water use. It's important that we're able to conserve those resources, help people use the product that we provide more efficiently. It avoids costs and avoids expansions in the future. And so that's one of the things I think that this council and previous councils have been committed to. It's a small thing, but one of the things we're testing this year, we have an electric truck pilot study for our central wastewater plant. We use a number of gasoline-powered or CNG-powered vehicles to run, to use for maintenance vehicles on our plant. We're looking at electric trucks, plug-in, so to speak, to see whether we can basically eliminate emissions and really be a greener wastewater plant. That sounds kind of odd to some people, but so we're excited about that small goal. Again, on page 16, what do you get for this budget? Well, you get 163 billion gallons of water treated and delivered to your customers. Plan on treating 73 billion gallons of wastewater to the high compliance levels that the state's established and that we meet without fail. We plan on replacing 135 miles of water and wastewater mains. Again, the leak detection in our distribution system, we've included additional funding for that. A lot of times we don't see the leaks until they blow out of the ground, in essence. And so we're able to find those before they show up, and that will allow us to save additional water, as well as infrastructure and streets and so forth and so on. And lastly, we'll be meeting, of course, our debt obligations, making our kind of our mortgage payments. On page 17, of the $511 million budget, you see the major drivers that that make up the increases associated with that. Labor, materials and power, so forth and so on. The next page is the key focus areas. That just shows you the services that we bid, so to speak, in this budget. You can see those outlined on that page. Getting into the way we calculate the rate increase on page 19, one of the things that we do is we look at how much money we budgeted for last year and then how much we think we'll get for this year without any rate changes. What this chart shows is the changes in the revenue assumption, similar to what the budget office does relative to its revenue requirements. You can see our interest income would drop slightly, wholesale revenues up substantially, and an assumption about sales loss here due to conservation. Bottom line on this chart, it tells you that I have a $24.5 million revenue requirement I have to recover from my retail customers, which basically drives that rate increase. On page 21, when you see the components of that recommended revenue, we have some fees and charges that are part of that, interest income, wholesale sales, and I want to point that out. The wholesale customers that purchase water from the city of Dallas make up almost $80 million of our revenue. They're an important part of our revenue stream, as well as the economies of scale that the utility benefits from. On page 22, you see a 6.3% retail rate increase. One of the measures that we use is how that fits into affordability, for lack of a better term. US EPA uses a guideline of about 2% of the median income, and this, for measurement purposes, is about 1.6 of that. So So from, I know it's going up, but from an affordability standpoint, we still are, I think, in pretty good shape. The next page shows a comparison of bill differences between what we propose and what our current bill is, and you can see the comparison between some of the other cities. They rank from as low as $36 in El Paso to as high as $82, so we match up pretty well there. The next chart also is a comparison that shows how we fit against our neighboring cities, and again, we have a pretty good price compared to those. The next part of this presentation focuses on our capital budget. If I go to page 27, you can see our capital program is about $320 million. We'll be funding that with commercial paper and equity or cash. And the Finance and Audit Committee has guided us to the expansion of a commercial paper program, which will help save on interest costs as well as dampen any need for the rate increase by allowing us to defer future bond sales. And it would be September 24th, we would be asking the council to also adjust our financial management criteria, as you can see on page 27. Again, the recommended program that for this next year is $320 million on page 28. It's made up of some pretty big chunks. Again, the water and wastewater main replacement program of 140 some odd million. Additional expansion requirements at our Eastside plant, which is where our largest plant expansion is going on, so it will be able to receive water from Lake Fork over the next few years. Southside wastewater treatment plant improvements, those solids processing, to name a few. Again, it's focused on infrastructure maintenance and renovation, so over two-thirds of that program is committed to that. The outlook is still challenging, but yet we embrace it. On page 30, you'll see where, again, our future capital program is in the mid to upper $300 million on average, and that's a commitment that we have to make sure we keep our utility running. The debt service costs are a big part of that. You'll see that on page 31. They're expected to grow, but not at a rate as we had expected. The next page on page 32 shows a forecast of where we think the retail rates might go. Of course, our challenge is that, you know, who knows what power will do. Power is about a $50 million component in our operating budget. So that's just to kind of give an outlook for that. The next page really talks a little bit about where we are in long-range water supply initiatives. It's a little hard to see from the screen, but what you can see is the different categories that we've been working on. The Lake Fork Connection, which is our next water supply that will come online later this year. We have Water Conservation Strategic Plan update, as well as our Drought Management Plan that's required by the state, and so forth and so on down that page. And I'd be glad to answer any questions about that if you have any. In summary, I'd like to just finish by saying that, you know, we are a large municipally owned regional water and wastewater supplier, wholly owned by the City of Dallas, and you are our board. We're self-supporting. Costs are driven by mostly infrastructure, and we have a responsibility for planning for water requirements for the entire service area. We've accomplished a number of things as a result of our employees' efforts through the recognition of programs that we provide, as well as, of course, I mentioned our bond rating. With that, there's a number of things in the appendix that are there for your reference, but I won't go through those. With that, Mayor, I'll turn it back to you.
Thank you, Mayor. In the water department, you know, you were speaking of the operation budget is probably over $500,000, and plus the capital budget is probably over $300 million. And I know you'll probably not be able to give me an answer today. Can you give me a detail and breakdown of what percentage of the MWBE numbers?
Okay. Yes, sir. To the degree that those portions are, or
they're separate. You know, one, is operation budget and one is a capital. You know,
right.
Both. I want a relationship
right.
To both.
to the degree with the materials we purchase and the projects we award. Well, I won't necessarily be able to give that to you for the proposed budget, but I could come up with an answer for the current year, because a lot of these things they haven't bought yet.
But give me the current, then we, once we do the budget, right, we can go forward
right
for next year.
Okay.
On page 26, I believe, you talk about rehab and replacement, the water line. Have you identified which one we need first and how you're going to expedite the one you replace, the worst case and the old one in the location?
Well, the way we go through the main replacement requirements is primarily by the number of main breaks and or property damage it might cause if it doesn't get replaced timely. And so those projects are kind of a needs assessment that are rolled into the designs and then are rolled into construction. So we have, for lack of a better term, a pipeline, no pun intended, of projects throughout the city that we push through that.
Okay.
In the event, I have an emergency type pipeline where we just can't keep it band-aided together long enough to get the normal bid process done. We do have a price agreement that allows me to go kind of attack that main in a hurry. But,
right,
but generally, we program that through based on breaks, for lack of a better term.
Based on breaks, but with the age of the city, we should have at least identified the oldest of the pipeline and location. Have we done that?
Yes, sir, and we have. And frankly, just because a line is old doesn't mean it needs to be replaced. Based on its performance, in other words, that the mains that you guys approved to whatever the last agenda was, most of those mains had breaks in excess of 30 breaks, and they were in pretty old condition. So those got the highest priority. So as soon as we can get them designed and get them bid, we go replace them. So I'm trying to answer your question. I'm not sure.
No, I guess what I'm asking is, number one, what is the lifetime of a pipeline, a water line?
The life cycle of pipelines is roughly about 50 years.
About 50 years. So if it's 50 years old, we probably have identified, you know, what pipeline's been here for 50 years. And we probably have identified if you got one break, which may be in North Dallas, for example, was 50 years old, and it broke twice. So therefore, we figured that it shouldn't break a third time.
Mr.
How do you identify? Yeah.
I don't know if this will address your question, but the $135 million that are earmarked in this budget for pipeline replacement, we already know which pipelines we're going to replace.
Right. And I want to know which one.
And we'll be happy to provide you with a list if that's what you'd
that's
like
right,
to see.
Right.
Yes, sir.
And do you have a schedule also, Ramon, when you decide when you want to replace those?
Yes.
And also need a schedule also. Page 27. We're speaking of the $300 million, which is the capital budget. No, I mean the commercial paper, I believe. Are you? Could you explain? You said eliminate the need for revenue bond sale for 09. Are you saying that 09, that in the proposed budget, that you would not have go back to the taxpayer if we decide to eliminate the revenue bond sale? Can we explain that, please?
Yes, sir. First of all, our revenue bond sales do not require a public vote to move those forward. The council takes the actions to do that. On an annual basis, like this year, we had a revenue bond sale of a little over $160 million to refund short-term debt. And when we prepare our budgets annually, we look at how to fund the capital program. So this time last year, when I came to the council and briefed our budget, we anticipated a bond sale in the 08-09 budget. But because of the assumptions for commercial paper, we're able to avoid that bond sale and still move our capital program together. In other words, we will be borrowing short-term debt and then refunding that at a later date because I have the ability to fund more projects with the $600 million.
And which one is cheaper?
The short-term debt is about 2% cheaper. In other words, 200 basis points. So The long-term debt is about 4.5%. These are kind of averages, where the short-term debt's about 2.5. We'll eventually have to pay it back, but it is acts as a line of credit.
Thank you, Mayor.
Thank you, Mayor. Jody, on page 16 or slide 16, you talk about a triple A bond, triple big A bond rating. And, of course, the city has gone, you know, we've had many discussions as to why the city, it's not in our best interest to have, for the city's general bond issuance, to have triple big A's. Have we investigated not having triple big A for the water department? And it seems to me, just from a very superficial perspective, if it's not worth our effort to do it on the city's general issuance of debt and so forth, why is it necessary to keep it for the water system?
I'm thinking Ramon wants to answer that.
Yeah, I saw that move there.
I guess my simple answer, Mr. Natinsky, is that I think that there are different criteria, obviously, that are being utilized to establish the bond rating by the rating agencies for the city, the municipality, versus the utility. If my memory serves me right, and I'm sure Ms. Suman or Mr. Cook can correct me, the largest challenge, if you will, with regards to trying to pursue a AAA bond rating for the municipality as a whole is the onerous reserves that the rating agencies would like to see us institute.
I will tell you, I think our responsibility to recommend to you the best financial situation we can for our utility and for our city, and then if they want to grade us AAA, AA, whatever, I think our responsibility is to recommend that to you.
I concur with that. Yeah. My question is sort of, you flip it around, the public sees, well, you're maintaining a triple big A for the water, why are you not?
Well, and the other thing is the grading is a little bit different in regards to, they think we need a huge reserve at the municipality.
Okay. On page 19, if I'm doing this, this is a Ramon question, Jody, I think, because I've asked it before, but I think it's going to come and catch us one day. You've got almost $4 million in replacement expenses that you have to achieve through the rate increase that are a result of conservation. I'm looking at the conservation / class usage line. That's almost $4 million, which, as you know, Ramon, goes back to, and I understand it, but it's hard for the public to understand that we've got this machine that we have to feed called the water system, and the more we save, in effect, I calculated that just about 1% of the 6.3% rate increase is because the citizens of the city of Dallas save more water.
That is correct.
And is there anything that we can do down the road, because I guess I'm concerned that, you know, at some point we continue to save, and yet they're paying for it, and the public says, well, why should I conserve? I mean, it's cheaper for me to use more water than it is to save. Now, I know that's not true, because if they use more water, then we've got to go build a bigger facility.
That's correct, and that's what you're doing. You're avoiding the cost of increasing capacity and or additional supplies. At a minimum, you're deferring those costs. There's also a point of diminishing returns, Mr. Natinsky. We'll be able, I believe that we will be able to make additional efforts with regards to conserving, but there'll come a point where you've squeezed all the juice out of the turnip, if you will. But you're absolutely correct. There are fixed costs associated with running the utility that do not go away. When we calculate at the pumpage how much we estimate we're going to sell this coming year, we made a reduction based on what we've learned from our customers in terms of what we believe they will consume next year through conservation.
Okay. Well, I would just like you all to think about some way for us to publicize or market the fact that while they may not see that conservation result this year, in the future, there are benefits to them conserving that will save them money. Because when you get down to the dollars and cents, that's where people start making a decision as to whether they're going to do something or not do something. I think the conversation you had with Mr. Adkins, I was going to ask the same question. My question was really simple. Do we maintain a needs the inventory list like we started off with streets and now we have with alleys and so forth, because I think that's a very simple way for both us and for city staff to, you know, pull up a list and here's the list, he's gone. In his absence, here's the list, Mr. Adkins, and where they are and why we think they need, you know, what the prioritization is for replacing them, which is totally separate from those that just blow up through the street. Last question on slide 32. Can you give just a little bit of more explanation as to why 09, we're, you know, 6.3, we're going to actually have a decrease in increase in 2010, a further decrease in increase in 2011, then we're going to jump back up to about 6.3 or something like that in 12. What are some of the drivers for the decrease in increase and then the increase in increase?
And I followed that question, so that, my coffee's working. The simple answer to that question is debt service. And there's a couple things that are happening in 2010 and 2011, and that we did a big bond refunding 2 years ago,
right?
Yeah, about $650 million. So we'll see the benefit of that savings in 2011. What will also happen is we'll have a large bond sale in, let me see if I got my years right, 2010 or 2011, which will pick back up some of that interest cost. So that's the simple answer to that question.
So the ups and downs are basically driven by changes in the amount of debt service that we're incurring in those particular years.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you, Mayor. Jody, good morning.
Morning.
First of all, we should all be very proud that we've got a utility, Dallas Water Utilities, that is in such great shape. So thank you. Thank you for your leadership. A while back, you gave us a briefing, I believe, about the customer agreements with these other 28 municipalities, and you said that the agreements were expiring or coming up for renewal. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And when are those coming up?
December 2009 is when the settlement agreement methodology technically expires.
Okay, so that's when those other customers, those other municipalities of ours, could in essence sign back up or go someplace else?
Well, their contracts don't expire. The methodology does. And the contracts have...
Methodology means the calculation of their...
Yes, the method by which we calculate their rates. There's a fairly complex methodology that was established back in the late 70s to determine the wholesale customer city's rates. And
when you say wholesale customers, you mean other municipalities, in essence.
Right, non-retail customers.
Non-retail customers.
For instance, we have agencies like a water district, or we have the, you know, city of Carrollton. They're wholesale customers.
Okay, have you gotten feedback from them about the proposed increases to the wholesale customers in this budget?
Yes, we have.
And?
They're very happy. I'm kidding. They concur with the. I mean, the numbers are the numbers. You know, we plug them into the machine and crank them out. Now, I do think that sometime before the end of this year, we'll be coming to council, both probably in public and executive session, to talk about the plans for that, the next steps for that methodology.
All right, and tied in with that is the question I asked last year at this very time. I remember the question. And that had to do with cost controls. Remember, I said, oh, my gosh. Maybe it was at a retreat or something. Or somewhere, I said, oh, my gosh, your operation's over $500 million. So my question that I asked last year that I ask again and again, remember, I started off by saying we should be very pleased that we have a utility that's so well run. What are we doing constantly in order to make sure we're controlling our costs in your $500 million enterprise?
Well, a couple things I think that we did as an example for this year's budget. Every year we really do scrub our budget. And one of the things we did this year is we looked at the way we were utilizing our FTEs. There's a section of our operation in engineering where we had hoped to be able to hire enough to do some in-house design,
mm-hmm.
but we weren't able to do that. So So, but what we were focusing on is trying to get ahead of leaks, because they create property destruction. Get ahead of leaks by shifting that money over to an enhanced leak detection program, because that's where cities throughout the country get a lot of bang for their buck. So I wasn't able to cut those costs, but I was able to reallocate those monies to this new program. We only cut, I think, we cut 4 FTEs, which in the big scheme of things doesn't sound like much.
But you have 1,500 employees, right?
That's roughly what I read. And so the other thing that's part of this budget, and actually the funding is in the capital program, is to implement a work order management system that we don't currently have, where we can actually better track the efficiency and performance of our repair activities.
Okay.
And so those are some things that we're focused on. I don't want to digress too much, but gosh, 4 or 5 years ago we did an efficiency study, and so we've implemented a number of those programs from that study that outside firm did.
A couple other questions, then I'll be done. Last year, the manager projected for a 9% increase this year in water rates, if I remember correctly.
10.
Why is it that you're only proposing a 6%, or 4.5% rather?
Mostly it's related to the commercial paper change.
So by virtue of the council going from the $300 million to $600 million, that the net interest savings is generating, really?
Mostly. Almost $10 million, if I recall correctly. So it's a big impact. We're using our capital much more efficiently by this change, thereby dampening the rate impact. I can't save the money, but at least
I can dampen that. I can encourage you enough. It's $831 million right. Is what you're spending. I said half a billion. Council members, it's $831 million. In this one lady here. I can't emphasize enough, I said it last year, I'll repeat again, the cost control element. Whether it is by the financing enterprise efforts or the other cost controls, that is just so rich with opportunity, and it has such an impact on our businesses, our neighborhoods, our citizens. I mean, it touches everyone. So I can't emphasize enough. In fact, I would ask of the manager to hear specific things that we're doing that or we propose to do with the Dallas Water Utilities to look at cost controls. I asked this last year, ask it again. I'd like to get back some more specific things. $831 million is a very rich target. I'm not saying you're wasting any money. That's too big a number for me not to be provocative to ask that question. Okay.
We'll be happy to provide you that, Mr. Newman. I would like to share one little statistic, if you'll allow me, that we're very proud of. We're running the utility today with about the same number of employees that we were running with 22, 25 years ago. And
that's very good.
We've increased our service area and increased our population significantly.
That begs the question. Is there any effort on Dallas Water Utilities to go get new customers?
Not actively.
Why not? I would think that would further spread our fixed cost.
It depends on who you take in. Most of the people you would go after have systems already. If their systems are not the quality for ours is, you're having to fix their systems too.
Well, I don't know. I don't know all the facts of it. Well, I'm just looking at ways of spreading out these fixed costs. And, you know, in the private sector, you generate savings by either cutting expenses or increasing your revenue. So, okay.
If I might add to that just a little bit, we had gotten an inquiry, for instance, from the town of Sunnyvale, which happens to be where our largest water treatment plant is located. So the council had set criteria about adding new customers to our system some years ago, and so we still operate under that. And they keep in mind, right now I have a group of customers I plan for.
Absolutely.
And so if I add another customer, well, I haven't planned for them.
But a year ago you didn't plan to have this $10 million of interest savings for the commercial paper financing. And now we have a $10 million savings, which impacts the user by having less water fees. So I just want us, I know we've been successful in the utilization of our employees, and it's a well-run operation. I just want, with $831 million flowing through the pipe, I just want us to be very conscious and be thinking about non-traditional things. Last question. I'm noticing several areas in my particular district, District 3, where our city has replaced wastewater lines or water lines, and the streets are nasty. What is the standard for repairing the street after we dig and put and finish the job? Do we bring the street back to equal to or better condition? What's the process?
That's pretty much the process. Typically, what happens in a main replacement, depending on whether it's a project we're coordinating with Public Works or not. Well,
okay.
Let me put it this way: we always coordinate with Public Works.
Okay.
We're pretty successful with that most of the time. We'll go back in and put a slurry over it so the street looks. What's the word I'm looking for?
Slurry, the coating.
Right.
Okay.
And a lot of times, for instance, in alleys, we'll go in and replace the alley to the standard because there's not much work there, but not much room there. But we're required to meet the utility cut standards on our construction projects as well as our main repair cut.
So there shouldn't be any uneven street when you're done with your project.
I wouldn't say that necessarily.
Because I'm seeing, and I sent you an email of the weekend.
I got those two streets.
Okay, yes, and there's more. Those are just the two that I thought of.
Yeah, it could also,
Mary Dale and Barbara.
It could also very well be that we're not done with the paving.
And I'm fine with that. I just have citizens that are saying, you know, we've got this new trench in here. Are they leaving? Oh, my gosh, is that the way? And I want to make sure I'm responsive to give them the facts.
And we'll work on being better at that as far as communicating what's going on and when that's going to happen. We're you know, I don't want to use weather as an excuse, but we are weather impacted on a construction site. But
I'm fine as long as we're committing to make sure the street is back in a good condition, because what we don't want to is improve the water and wastewater line and then create gullies. You know, by virtue of the indentation.
And the backfill, hopefully that's just temporary paving.
I do too. Well, you'll hear otherwise.
Yeah.
Okay.
So will you.
Yes. Oh, no, I'll hear first, and then you'll get it next. Thank you very much, Mayor.
Thank you very much. Mr. Zansky?
Mr. Mayor, thank you. Jody, thank you for your report. Very quickly, Mr. Newman's question. If I remember right, Jody, we passed an ordinance about 3 or 4 years ago that if X square footage of a street was torn up through utilities, we had to patch the whole thing. Would you get him a copy of that ordinance? Yes, no, I'm waiting for you. Okay, there's an ordinance that we passed that talks about what you're doing. I think you ought to see it.
Yeah.
And another thing, I think the utility companies have 6 months or something to get back in there, don't they?
That's my recollection, Mr. Rodansky. But those utility cut issues all apply to us as well.
Mr. Newman, actually, if you go in there and they tear up and patch and X number of a street, then it's like over 30% or 40%. They have to pave the whole thing. But they'll get you a copy of it. I have several questions, Jody. One has to do with page 17. And again, I'm going to talk about our pilot program, payment in lieu of taxes. I was never supportive of economic development, taking money out of our water department for economic development. That's just my thinking. That's how I operate my business. Every business stands on its own. If there's something in economic development that we should be getting back from the developers, such as appraisal fees, this or that, that is how, in my opinion, that should be how it should be happening. We have a total of about $6 million that you have talked about this upcoming budget. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Okay. Now I want to go to page 27. On page 27, am I seeing that we have around $68 million in cash?
There is equity in our budget, or cash transfers budgeted.
Is that the monthly average balance?
No, that is actual cash that when... Let me take 2 steps back. That is actually revenue we receive that will be then transferred to our construction fund to fund projects that require cash for instance, like a lagoon cleaning.
About what that account, what would you say the average balance is in that account, monthly average?
The oh, gosh.
Would you say?
I don't.
Dave, do you know, Mr. Cook? Well, to me, that's a...
But that's not a cash balance. That's a funding amount that will be used to help fund the $320 million in projects. Our annual cash, year-end cash balance has run $26, $28 million is my memory. Okay. Year-end balance.
That's a year-end.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, okay. The only reason I'm bringing that up, to me, one way is funds is to manage our cash very good. And we're helping on that by raising from $300 to $600 million in short-term borrowing. Because even that saves about $5.5 million a year on that, which is plugged in. That is plugged into your new.
Yes, sir.
Now, my question to you is, and I always look at it this way: what is the maximum we can have? Is it 600 or 650, 640, 610, 680? I would like you to get back to me. What is the maximum? Because I want to use that to its fullest to save our water department. Report back to me as chairman of finance and audit. If we can go to 670, I'll talk to some of my colleagues. That's maybe what we should be doing, because $70 million that we can go in short-term borrowing at 200 basis points difference, that's $1.4 million a year. So I would like to know what is the maximum we could do. On the bottom of the page, it says change from 10 to 20% tax-exempt commercial paper to the 10-year capital improvement program. I'd be very frank with you, unless I got a good case of Alzheimer's, I don't ever remember us discussing that.
I think when we had our August 12th briefing, we identified that in that briefing. We have a financial management performance criteria that limits our commercial paper program to 10% of the 10-year capital improvement program. That's when you ask the question about... what amount can we authorize?
Yeah, we had an F&A meeting. This is my red bear. We had an F&A meeting that morning, but I just don't remember us discussing it unless it was on future things. I would like to talk to you about that.
Okay.
Because I can see where that might cost us just a little bit.
It just creates a fence line, for lack of a better term.
A big fence.
Well, but nonetheless, that's consistent with the $600 million.
Okay, Mr. Natinsky hit on it, it takes a lot of looking into. What is it going to cost us to reduce us? You know, everybody would like to have AAA rating, but if we reduced it to AA rating. You know, our long-term bond debt, interest rate is going to rise a little. But if we have we had anybody really look at that? If we were AA rather than AAA, and we, I think we need to take a look at it. What would it release? What would it release some capital that we might have that we could put back into the water department? For less borrowing.
We can consult with our financial advisor.
Well, that's the problem. We consult with our financial advisor. They do the underwriting of a bond.
No, they don't do the rating,
ma'am.
But they don't do the
same
rating.
Route that they have.
Well,
I've been talking about this for 7 years down here. It's still part of the umbrella. That's the problem.
I understand. I think earlier when we talked about the way utilities are rated, I think maybe that will help a better understanding of that. I mean, I'll be frank with you. The one way to lower the rating is stop investing in your utility.
Yeah.
And that'll lower your rating.
You know, Friday night, I looked at it, said it was delivered to me, colleagues, DFW package for their, for tomorrow's F&A meeting, their budget. They put something in there very interesting, Ms. Soon, that I think you ought to take a look at. It was a very... not 100% pleased with it because I've got a lot of questions tomorrow. But they put in a page or two where they were able to tighten their budget. A great idea that DFW board had. There was a one or maybe a page and a half where they were tied in their budget. This they were able to save doing this. This were, and they put a total, and you trace that back to their budget on each item. Great idea the board had. We should be looking at that, each of our departments, where they can save. It's not in here.
No, it's not. And okay. But we have done that, and I can certainly give you a list.
I know, but we're not like the illusionists down here.
I'll be glad to get you the list.
Okay, but if we could do this in the future. My last thing is a very small thing. You know, we look for ways in which to sell advertising for the city of Dallas. Additional revenue and income. I brought this up 4 or 5 years ago. We spend probably hundreds of thousands of dollars a year in postage. I would love to see a bid program for our envelopes and our mailers to bid it out with some name in there to pay for our postage. And, you know, everybody is doing this now. But let's take a look at how much we spend on postage and have the envelope or whatever, you know, it might say whatever, you know, this bank does business with the city of Dallas, and have them pay for the postage. You know, it goes out to what, 400,000 accounts we have?
Over 300,000, about 340,000, I think.
Okay, 350,000. Good way to get somebody's name out there and to save the city maybe a couple hundred thousand dollars a year in postage. We should take a look at least the mailings, fare and back return envelopes. Thank you, Jody. Thank you very much. Thank you, Ramon.
Thank you, Mr. Rozanski. Ms. Hill, please.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Ms. Puckett, thank you for not only an excellent presentation, but your tremendous knowledge in this area and your continued vigilance of our water supply. Will you go with me, please, to page 33? I want to talk about the long-range plan a little bit. Is the Sabine one of our present reservoirs?
We have two reservoirs in the Sabine Basin, Lake Tawakoni, which has been a workhorse in our system for years, and then Lake Fork, which is a little east of Lake Tawakoni. It is the lake we're in the process of connecting now. So currently we have two lakes in that basin. I'll also remind you that the Toledo Bend Reservoir is an alternative strategy for us, part of our long-range plan. It is located, of course, somewhat south of us on the Louisiana-Texas border.
So what are we looking at concerning the Sabine? Are we looking at how much we're pulling from there? Are we looking at pulling more? What are we looking at?
Well, we're looking at how we might use our two lakes, plus the potential of Toledo Bend long-term in making sense for our needs. For instance, there may be a way to use Toledo Bend water without building a pipeline. And it's a series of trading water that we do that allows us to take Toledo Bend water, for instance, when Lake Fork is spilling, because that water is going to go on downstream to Toledo Bend.
Okay.
And so as we try to look at the alternative strategies and options to the city, you know, where can we take advantage of those relationships, of a long relationship with the Sabine River Authority? And so that's one of the things we're looking at there.
Okay. Same page. On the partnership with Tarrant Regional on Palestine Water, talk to me a little bit about that. Where are we on that? Does that look good, not good? Where are we on that?
Well, I'm really glad you brought that up. I expect to be back to our council committee in the next couple of months regarding where we are. The opportunities for that look great, actually, to cost share and a pipeline between here and Lake Palestine. Also, there's an opportunity to share water with them as well, which is an opportunity that lets us utilize all of our supplies a little differently. So that's a pretty expensive project in the $500 to $800 million range long term. So I big plan on bringing that back for discussion later this fall.
And that just allows me to segue into Oklahoma. I hear that Oklahoma has become willing to sell water to Fort Worth, Tarrant County.
Where is that? Or is that true or not?
Well, gosh. Oklahoma Water has always been an interesting option for the North Texas area. Back in 2000, the agencies visited with Oklahoma, and then there was a moratorium on the sale of water out of Oklahoma. I do know that Tarrant Regional Water District had sued on a Federal Trade Commission violation, and that's in the courts waiting for, and I'm going to practice law, and it's dangerous because it's not my strength, and that's waiting response from the court. Now, recently, the city of Irving entered into some relationship with the city of Hugo, which I don't know the specific details of, to be honest with you.
Hugo, Oklahoma.
Uh-huh, Hugo, Oklahoma. For, I think the name of the lake is Lake Hugo. And so that may also involve some litigation before it's over. The role we have right now with our relationship with Tarrant Regional is basically kind of a supporting cast to see how that lawsuit turns out. So
let me interrupt you for just a second. Ms. Coop, can you add something to that?
I did talk to one of the Irving City Council members just recently, just to add something to that. I think it was a relationship between the town of Hugo, but I also think it had to do with the Native American Indians that lived there and their ownership of the water. So you might want to look at that, and I do think it's going to end up being in court. But the question, I guess, is did you make it with the state of Oklahoma or did you make it with the Indian tribe there? And I think that is a distinction that is going to probably have to be tried out in court.
So the
That's
water
my understanding of it.
It may not belong to the state of Oklahoma?
Yes.
That
okay.
was my understanding.
Okay. It's complicated by the Indian nations as well as the state, as well as the Bureau of Land Reclamation. So it's a complicated process, and we kind of felt like that the Tarrant Regional District was taking the right steps regarding that issue.
Okay.
We're not sure how the Irving situation will turn out.
I have three other questions, and then I'll be done. And these questions are things my colleagues have raised, and I want to revisit. One thing that Mr. Rozanski raised, Mr. Rozanski is, of course, the financial wizard, and I would never argue with him on finances, but I have a different perspective on the bond rating when it comes to the water utility. I think we have done an absolutely fantastic job of planning out for the next 50 years or so, and we've got to keep, I think, a large reserve in order to continue that planning and building the system accordingly. And as I understand it, the amount of the reserve is what affects the bond rating. Do I have that correct, or do I need some help in getting that straight?
Not as much on water utility as maybe what they look at on a general fund side. I think one of the issues that the rating agencies look at on bond ratings for utilities is your revenue and the investment back in your infrastructure that allows you to produce your product.
Okay.
So, for instance, if I have 40% of my water running down the curb because all my mains are broken, then I'm not investing in my utility and I'm wasting money. So I think that the measures are different, and it may be helpful, and I'll have to consult with Dave and maybe some others. There may be kind of a profile of how do you rate a utility versus maybe a municipality from a debt standpoint. That might help.
I want to keep whatever investment, whatever financial mechanism allows us to continue on the very forward-looking and cutting-edge role that we've had in looking at our water supply long-term, because we are not in the trouble that some other people are in, and some other folk are continuing to try to grab our water because we have planned properly, and I want us to continue on that path, whatever that takes. The second thing is page 17, and that's the pilot program. Again, as I understand it, the water utility pays that money, whereas a regular business would actually pay taxes. We would take that regular business's taxes
and invest it through the general fund wherever we thought best suited. Now, as I understand it, that's exactly what we do in the pilot program. We take that money, which is just like taxes, and we invest it wherever we think it's best suited. And the council has made a decision that that's best suited for economic development, which is like that grocery store I got out in Pleasant Grove. Again, is my understanding correct, or do I need some help in getting straight what I understand?
Now, yeah, I think your understanding is right on. You know, back in the 90s, I can't remember the year, the voters approved a charter change that allowed the utility to be taxed. And so it's paying its taxes, in essence, here. And frankly, I think we're not fully taxed. I think if I were taxed at the full value that's taxable, I think it'd be something in the $13 million range. So I think that's off the top of my head, that's the number that comes to mind. So I'm paying at 50%, so to speak, of my valuation.
And I'm very much interested in utilizing that tax for economic development. Mr. Atkins and I, actually not just us, but all of the Southern Sector folk are working very hard to bring certain things, certain incentives to the Southern Sector, and some of that money will go to some of that, and we're interested in keeping that money in economic development.
That is the fund we're looking to do things, and this actually gives us a little bit more flexibility than we've had in the past.
And that's where we want to keep it.
And to clarify that, these monies go into the public-private partnership fund. They don't go to the general fund. They go into the public-private partnership fund for those purposes.
My final comment, this goes to Mr. Newman's point about looking at new customers. Those new customers, if we go out and get them, again, as I understand it, will have some kind of water system. They're not sitting out there not drinking water or taking baths. They have a water system in place. In order for us to either take over their system, connect to their system, or otherwise interact with their system, may cost us more than it's worth. Again, is my understanding correct?
It could, and there's a couple of different ways to look at that issue. One, from a wholesale standpoint, where you don't actually buy their system and kind of acquire a retail system, that you actually just serve them with wholesale treated water, for instance. That's probably a pretty good deal for us, but there's a limited opportunity for that because there's other wholesale suppliers around that are already serving them. In the case of a retail system, depending on the investment you have to make and what you might get for incorporating that into your system, it could be upside down, so to speak, on the cost benefit. You just have to look at the whole picture of it. It's on an individual basis.
Again, I want to be cautious about that. I certainly don't want to turn down any revenue stream, but I want to be cautious. Based on my work back at the Public Utility Commission and water, I want to be very cautious about some of the systems that are around that would become potential customers.
Ms. Hill, if you would allow me, if you'll look at the slide that's on the screen right now, I think it's important to note there are three major purveyors that serve the North Central Texas area, the DFW Metroplex. And we are, as Ms. Puckett likes to call us, the meat and the sandwich. If you look to the west of us and actually wrapping around to the south of us, Tarrant Regional serves the area. And then if you look to the east of us, it's North Texas. The state of Texas, through the water planning process, has in fact designated service areas for the utilities. And so what you see there is our service area as defined or as designated by the state for us.
All right. Thank you both for that. And again, my compliments for your significant thought in planning a long way out for water. If we don't plan for water now, for the next 50 to 100 years, we are going to be sorry we didn't. And y'all have kept that in mind and have done a very, very good job of it. Thank you very much. Thank you, Mayor.
Thank you, Michelle. Mr. Cadet, please.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I'm going to continue on where Ms. Hill was talking on the long range. She's gotten I have answered most of my questions. One I wanted to ask was, how many reservoirs have we located? And I know we lost one through the state that we were supposed to get, did we not?
Well, we haven't lost yet.
Well, I hope not.
If you go back to Erica, the map that to right. refer to this map, you can see the major lakes that we have connected right now. There are the Trinity River lakes, which are Ray Roberts and Louisville and Grapevine, Lake Ray Hubbard and Lake Tewakene. Those are our current water supplies. And to the east of Lake Tewakene is the Lake Fork, which we already have rights in. Not on this map, and further south down here in Henderson is where Lake Palestine is. That's our next existing supply. So the plus is we have inventory, for lack of a better term, to bring online to serve us through about 2035. Lake Faster was the one, Mr. Cadane, you were mentioning about losing. We haven't lost that fight yet. And so we're still, that one's located as a proposed site south of Lake Palestine, Cherokee County, down that direction. The other lake, which is further east, in the Sulphur River Basin near Paris, east of Paris, is Lake Wright-Patman. And we are looking to gain additional about 100 MGD out of that lake. That process has been kind of slow right now because of the Sulphur River Basin study, Region D and C and D subcommittees that came out of the legislature. But the chart that's in your packet shows the progress we're making on the others. So we're continuing to take steps forward.
You had a Sulphur Basin up north also, didn't you? Northeast?
In the Sulphur River Basin,
yeah.
Is where Wright-Patman is.
That's up north, right?
That's north and east of here.
Right, okay.
Cooper Reservoir is a lake that water comes into this region.
Do we have total access to Tewakene?
We have 80% of Tewakene.
80?
Mm-hmm.
80%.
And then the rest of the water is contracted to others by the Sabine River Authority, as is Palestine. Typically, the out-of-basin relationships leave water in that basin for future customers, and those kind of relationships I don't expect to change long term.
So do you feel like we're online for our 50-year future budget?
So far.
So far.
I think the next 10 years for us are going to be critical. Both in water conservation, our reuse program, and in the acquisition of additional supplies.
Okay, well, it's one thing we need to really keep up on as it's happening. If you keep us up when we get what we are getting.
Yes, sir.
I appreciate that. And, okay, then let me go into, from that, go to the wholesale water. Do we have the right to regulate that? If we have to regulate our water, do we regulate what we sell to the wholesalers?
We regulate our wholesale relationships through their contracts.
Yes.
And for instance, I'll use conservation as an example. They have to have like measures based on what's in our contract.
Mm-hmm.
Also, though, those cities are all required to have water conservation plans on file with the state. So it's not just our citizens carrying the freight. Our customer cities are also having to carry that freight as well.
Okay.
So we don't, the city's role in regulation has primarily to do with the rates and what's in our contract.
But we have to give them, okay, they're doing their own regulation.
Internally within their city.
Okay. Now, then let me go to your master plan on your mains. How far are we along on that master plan?
For
this year, for this budget, how much will we complete of that master plan?
Regarding the water and wastewater main replacement?
Yes.
We need to replace about 100 to 150 miles a year, and so this just keeps us on that path.
So this will keep us up with what we need to be doing.
Right. And it's unfortunately, it's a perpetual.
I know, that's what I'm saying. But hopefully we're using Well, I guess the material we use, is it good for over 50 years?
Yeah. Well, one of the challenges is back in the mid-60s, cast iron and ductile iron pipe were used.
Yeah.
They don't like it here very much.
Yeah.
And so that's where we're seeing the bulk of our replacements. Most of the pipeline you see is going in as a PVC. One of the things, too, that is in this proposed budget is a carbon fiber replacement for rehabbing our large transmission mains. And so some of you might remember the 84-inch that blew out up near White Rock Lake a few years ago. We have large pipelines like that across the city, and in order to repair them, it's a substantial effort to take them out of service. This allows us to repair them from the inside out, and since that event, and we had stepped up quite substantially the maintenance and leak detection programs associated with those mains.
So we're keeping up with the 150 miles a year.
Yes, sir.
And because I know you had quite a few main breaks this past year.
Right, especially when the pressures come up,
yeah.
You'll have a few more main breaks. Dry weather sometimes you'll get cracks and breaks in mains.
So we're doing those even over and above what your budget is or plan?
Now, it's just part of the plan. Our distribution division will have to go out and repair that main. It may very well likely be a main that's scheduled to be replaced as well. And so, to me, the combination, it's really a three-legged stool, the combination between leak detection, our ongoing operations for repair, and our replacement program will help bolster that system even more.
Well, I thank you all for what you are and how you're doing it, because you're doing an excellent job. I know we had a very large break in my district,
yeah.
And I don't think we were ever without water. And I don't know how you do that, how you cut a main, and you still give us water.
I think one of the important parts of our system, just to share with you a little bit, is that it's...
Yeah, I better watch it.
Till today.
I'm getting pure lake water in there.
our system has redundancies in them that allows us to move water around by turning valves on and off. And so it's designed that way for that very reason, and it's really, to me, the people forget sometimes the reason public water supplies are so important, that's fire protection. And so they were able to provide those loop systems to help support that as well.
Yeah, I think they had to turn off 10 valves or something before they could even stop that water from flowing. But thank you all so much for all you're doing in the water department. And Judge Hill, I want to make sure we've got the water for the future. Thank you. Thank you, Mayor.
Thank you, Mr. Cadane. Ms. Davis, please.
Thank you, Mayor Leffert. I have a couple of questions. On page 36, what is street rental?
Street rental is a franchise fee, for lack of a better term, that we pay the general fund. It's 4%. Is it 4%? 4% of our retail revenues that we pay, kind of like a TXU would, or I don't know if they still pay franchise, Mary, I don't remember. TXU.
Yeah, this is franchise taxes that the water department put back into the budget?
Right. It's an expense to our ratepayers that we pay the general fund for actually having our mains in the streets of the city.
Okay. Who pays? Do the customer pay for this?
The customer pays for this. It's included.
How much is it?
It's about $16 million total.
Is it on our statement?
It's embedded in the rate. It's not separated out as a tax or a separate line item. And we've been paying that for, golly, at least as long as I've worked for, 26 years.
Well, the customer don't know that. That's why I asked. Okay. Next, other service. What is other service?
Other services include... charges that we pay internally for computer charges. That includes charges we pay the Trinity River Authority for wastewater services.
Mm-hmm.
Just a host of things like that.
So I like to see what's in those other services.
Okay.
Also, debt service. Why is it so high?
Because we have $1.8 billion in outstanding debt.
Because
we have to build things in order to deliver our services, and our primary way of doing that is to borrow the money. And so we issue revenue bonds ultimately to do that, and then that debt service is kind of our mortgage payment to make those debt payments.
Mary, how do we pay that back?
Through the charges for the water. It's part of the bill, yes.
So the customer pays that back, is it?
Customers pay all of it, yeah.
Okay. Since the customer are paying street rental, they're paying the debt service, what type of programs do we have for seniors?
We have
them on their water payment. So if a senior calls in, like I get some seniors, they call in and their water is turned off, or they don't know that they have any senior programs. So what programs do we have based on the amount of money that I'm paying and my constituents are paying for water? What type of programs do we have?
We do not, in the utility, offer any specific programs for seniors. We have a donation program through the Operations Water Share in the Salvation Army that is available for people to contribute, kind of like electric companies where they get donations to help people. When our seniors struggle, we work with our environmental health services, our senior services, to help them. And occasionally, when we have challenges, we create payment programs to help them.
Mary Lepper, do you think we need some type of senior programs? We pay so much back into water?
Yeah, I just wanted to make one thing really clear. Jody said, we do have a donation program that seniors can avail themselves of. It's that we, on your bill, you can donate, and we get how much do we get a year from that, Jody?
Cash, I don't remember.
But there is the average senior in the South Dallas who water is getting turned off because they cannot afford to pay the water bill. And you look at debt service. And I understand, you know, street rental, this is stuff that's coming out of that they're paying for. You don't think we need some type of program to help them? Just like TXU, they have a program.
Well, I would check on the TXU program, but I'm just saying the water department does have a donation program that they can avail themselves of. We just probably need to make them more aware of what it is and where it is.
Okay. The TXU and this program are roughly the same.
Right, yeah.
Well, I think we need to do something on that, because I have a number of seniors are calling in where their water is getting turned off for whatever reason. They cannot afford it. When you look at the street runner, the other service, and debt service, and the amount of money that we are paying into debt service, surely we should have some type of program for our seniors. That's something we can talk about another time. On page 51. On the capital improvement needs. Jody, is this all the capital improvement for that's left a part of our capital improvement by district, or this is just, explain this page 51 to me.
Page 51 in your appendix is a list of projects and project types that we propose to do in the utility. It is separate from the City General Obligation Bond Program, and this listing is determined based on project needs and master plan requirements and regulatory requirements that the utility has. It, don't show that, Erica, because it's sideways up there. And so that's what these projects are. We have a 10-year capital improvement program, and that we work off of that list of work as we move forward into each budget year.
So this is a 10-year?
This is 1 year of a 10-year capital program.
Okay, so how will I find out the capital improvement in District 7, the capital improvement needs in District 7?
I can provide those to you.
Okay, but it won't be a part of this here.
It's not listed like that here, but we have a way to give you a list of projects that we've got scheduled for your district.
Okay, on the Trinity River, What part of our on our Trinity River will we be talking about water? Is it any, are we going to have any long-term discussion concerning water when it comes to our Trinity River?
Well, our role related to the Water Utilities role related to Trinity River has to do with a couple of different things. We have some utility relocations, mm-hmm. which will have to be funded in order to get out of the way of the river project, as well as a water reuse component to provide inflows to the lakes. And so those are the two major components pieces that we as the utility would have.
What happens to the water that we save, you know, the conservation water that we save from what's that, from June to October in the summer months, where we can't use the water at a certain time and all that?
What happens to the water?
Uh-huh.
Well, it simply is that it stays in inventory, for lack of a better term. I don't have to pull that water out of the lakes to treat it and then deliver it to customers. So, in essence, it's just saved in inventory.
Okay.
So it's there for the next month, so to speak.
Okay. And then when do we finally use that water?
Well, whenever the demand rises, mm-hmm. Then we provide that water. And I guess another way to look at it is that if I've saved 100 gallons during the time of day watering period, then that's the first 100 gallons I use the next month.
And based on that, we're saving. Next year, will we still have to have a small increase to the...
Based on our capital program and our expectations of the increase in the commodity costs, chemicals, and power, I would expect one. And we'll work to try to keep that as small as we can, but I would expect one. And that's shown in one of your slides.
I saw that, but when does it get to a point, perhaps... where we might not need a water increase, a slightly water increase?
I don't see an easy way to get there, but I'm very attuned to, and I pay the bill too, and so I'm very attuned to the future as far as where the increases are going. So are we doing everything we can to keep them from going up and are, you know, holding those down?
The water department is supposed to be changing out the water meters to kind of help save. Have they started changing out the water meters?
Mm-hmm. Well, there's two things we do. One, we have a meter replacement program based mm-hmm. on age. And so we have that funded through our capital program. If there's a situation where we have a stuck meter or something where the bill just doesn't look right, we also have an exchange program. The other program that we've piloted is an automated meter reading program, and that is scheduled to get finally rolling here, completed later this year, so that we can read meters automatically. And then it's our goal to expand that long term, but we haven't gotten there yet.
But if you're in an area that was built in 1920 or 1930, Do you replace those meters?
If that meter is scheduled to be replaced, I mean, that property does not have the 1930 water meter in it.
Okay.
And so we have a schedule by which we go and replace meters based on age, and I think it's about 15 years.
Can you give me a copy of the meters in my district, please?
A copy of the meters?
That needs to be replaced.
What?
Would you know that or have that?
I may have a list of meters that are scheduled to be replaced.
Okay,
let me do some research and I'll get back with you on the data.
Okay. Now, you talked about, you was earlier talking about water rights. What happens to, once we get the water rights, then do we get a fee from that? On
no,
the water rights?
No, once we acquire a water right,
uh-huh.
I'll use Lake Fork as an example.
Okay.
We have a contracted right for that water with the Sabine River Authority.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The state of Texas owns all the water and permits that water to agencies.
Okay.
And so we pay a price for that water, having the right to use that water to whoever owns it. And in this case, Lake Fork being an example, is the Sabine River Authority is the owner. And so We also pay a fee to the state for water rights we own as part of their cost of regulation.
Okay. And I have the very last one. When you go over the Forest Avenue Bridge, it has a very, very bad odor. It's been like that for years. And I was told that it is a water treatment plant somewhere down in that area. Is that true?
I think that's near where the central wastewater treatment plant is,
mm-hmm.
if I recall.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there may be odors emitting from that plant. There are also
bad odors
adjacent to that, a facility adjacent to that plant.
Can we do this? Because the odor is so bad over there. And I don't know if anybody has really studied it. It just odor just all over our neighborhood. Can you give me some information on why is there odor when you go over that bridge and it goes into South Dallas?
Jody, there's a rendering plant there too, isn't there?
There is.
Yeah. Might be that too. Might be the water and the rendering plant.
Who owns the rendering plant?
I don't know, but
I don't remember the name of the company.
Just
a minute.
The water, we need to look into that.
We've done quite a bit of work related to odor controls at that plant. I'd like to get with you offline maybe to go through where we are and what we've done.
Yeah, because that odor is really, really bad. So if you can get with me, and then we can perhaps talk about what we can do to fix that problem.
Okay.
I would appreciate it. Thank you so much, Jody.
Thank you very much.
Jody, thank you very much for the work that you do and the work of your staff that you do. Did I read it correctly? It's 164 billion gallons a year?
163 billion gallons
a year. I have a hard time comprehending that. You know, I try to equate that to the 2 or 3 gallon gasoline can that I take. And I still up
Quite
there,
warm.
Yeah, and try to quake that. That's a lot of water when it's all said and done. I do remember reading. Did you not receive your department a award for 10 years in a row, or at least the last decade of having? Well, tell me that award.
Yeah, it's a treated water quality award from our water treatment plants. As far as now, the title of it just it's gone. But as far as meeting high water quality standards associated with the American Water Works and EPA.
And I remember reading, I point this out, colleagues, is that there was only 3 other cities in the United States of America from coast to coast, only 3 other cities that ever received that for 10 years running. True statement?
True.
So we got water quality, we got good water quality, proven record on that. And then as I look on page 23 and 24, I see that we're either at the middle or below the middle of the list when it comes to residential bills, which that's a good thing. So from that day-to-day management, I feel pretty good about it. Quality of water, the product we're putting out is good, the cost is good. The one thing is council money, and Judge Hill, this is where I will agree with you and look forward to your leadership on the legislature's ad hoc as chairman of that, is the long-range planning. That's what this council will be remembered for in years to come, is the long-range planning for this water, because we've got it already under control from efficiency standpoint, but long-range planning. And I will say, just like with this last lake, we haven't given up on it yet, but it's I'm going to use the word, and I usually don't use strong words, but shallow-minded when it comes to this U.S. Fish and Wildlife for fighting us on this.
No kidding.
Yeah, that is shallow-minded. So, Judge, I'll be there in the corner with you for the long-range planning, because, again, that's what this council will be remembered for. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Kelly, please.
Thank you, Mayor. And I was listening, and Jody, you know, you've been doing a fantastic job. Let me just kind of piggyback on some of the things that Councilwoman Davis was saying. When you cross the Cedar Crest Bridge, Martin Luther King Bridge, Cedar Crest, on the Cedar Crest, to your left, you have Ms. Madrano's district as related to Cadillac Heights. You have Ms. Davis's district on the right where the avenues are, and our state rep's office is. And then just beyond that, you have District 4. And here's the deal. And ironically, as Ms. Davis was just speaking about the smell, this is a perfect time for me to ask you, since we're talking about water, and to chime in about that smell. Number one, the number one concern that we have in our area, and I live about 2.5 miles from the foot of that bridge, and last Friday night, standing on my front porch, 2.5 miles away, we could not stand it. Okay, something is going on in that area. Let me tell you partly of what is going on. Then, Jill Jordan, I'm gonna need to ask you a couple things because it does involve the Trinity as well, possibly. There's a company called Texas Byproduct. Okay.
Texas what?
Texas Byproduct. There's a rendering plant.
No. Oh.
We see them going in, and we see trucks going in. But I've had some private folks investigating it because down in there something is going on. Now we see them going in, we don't see them bringing nothing out. So whatever they are making. We don't see if they're making dog bones or dog food. We don't see the pickup of it, but we see stuff coming in and the empty trucks when they're leaving. But Mayor, the number one concern in that area is stinky. I mean, when I say it's stinky to the 15th power, it is stinky. And we've been enduring this for a period of time. Now, Jill, I've asked you, you might want to come to the mic, because it's a part of the Trinity. And one other reason that I'm saying as relates to the Trinity Forest, what is, because if we've been down there, we should know what's there. What is right at the foot of that bridge at 11th Street, between 11th Street and the Trinity, just right behind, you know where Barbara's office is on the corner? What's back there, behind the packing house and that big metal scrap yard? What is back there?
On the Oak Cliff side?
Yes, ma'am.
And you don't mean at Corinth, you mean...
No, I'm talking about Cedar Crest.
Cedar Crest. I don't know, I'll have to check on that.
Okay, and I need to know more than I don't know, because here, let me tell you why. Because one, that's a part of the Trinity, and we all know. Mm-hmm. Okay? And I'm not trying to put you on the spot, but I'm just saying. And we don't know what's going on down there, because all of the clearing of the Trinity stopped when we got to the Dart Rail. Why is it that we stopped right there? This is not the Trinity, and we'll do this in a Trinity briefing. But just there, the clearing stopped. And something is right in that area. And I've had some private investigators to go down and do some research, and they've brought all types of horror stories back about what may be going on. But we, and let me just cut mine short. What I'd like for us to do, and I'd like to know this week, I want to know what's going on. I would like to know what's down there. And furthermore, I'd like for us to take a tour. Can we do that today? At some point, we just get in the van and go over there and we'll go see.
No, not me.
Can we do that? I mean, whoever, let's try to get it. Let's just do that today. Let's go back there and let's get me a truck or a van, and let's go together, and let's just go see, and then we can answer these questions, because Cedar Crest wants us, and Dr. Johnson and I were talking just this morning, and he would like for us to come in with some type of a explanation at their next meeting. But I do want to say this is just not starting. This has been all my life, because we used to blame it on Procter & Gamble when they were making the soap.
It used to be Procter & Gamble.
Yeah, well, it used to be Procter & Gamble on that side.
That's correct.
Yeah, but on this side, what they do, they bring in this old grease, and it was said that it might be going off into our facilities, and that's something we need to know. When I say our facility, our river, okay? But some reason, once a stinky thing of grease get stirred up, then, and the wind is blowing, And it's been sitting there. It's tough. Now, I know y'all, we got to know what we're doing now. I'm not putting us on the spot, but I want to go today. In fact, I'm ready to go as soon as we get through and we get a little break. Y'all order trucks. Let's go down there and see. But the name of the company is Texas Byproduct. They do not have the proper licensing even to be there. I want us to check that as well. I want to be publicly on record with it because they have a scrap metal yard. They do not have the proper COs to be there. But they are illegally operating as we said. So I'd like to get a full report of just that area and immediately. Thank you. Just fast can.
Appreciate it. Mr. Atkins, please.
Environmental and everybody else.
It's cool. You in environmental, you know, I've been in Dallas for many, many years. I know sometimes, you know, when it's dry, you know, the Trent River is low. The smell is, you can smell it worse when it's low. Is there any reason why do that occur? Do that, you know, I'm just curious, you know.
I don't know about the smell, but obviously in lakes and rivers when the water is low and isn't running, you'll get an algae bloom and that kind of thing. So I think that I noticed that same smell when you go to Arlington on the bridge going about halfway between here and Arlington. I've always wondered that as well. Well, I'm not sure what it is out there.
Well,
okay, so that's a treatment plant.
If I might, the odors may be the same generator. They may not be.
At
our central plant, we've had devices called trickling filters that we're replacing. They produce odor. And so that's unfortunately a byproduct of some of the waste treatment. So we're phasing those out. But what you probably smell, you don't smell the river, you smell the treatment plant. And that's a central TRA plant that's just south of 30.
I guess the question would be, and maybe bring back to the committee, is the odor that's emanating from both maybe that treatment plant and our treatment plant perhaps, is that harmful to the environment or not?
That's correct.
And just because it smells badly, I don't know that. I mean, I don't know that it is harmful to people, although it may be obnoxious to people. So I guess that would be the question now. The question about the byproducts, the rendering plant, I don't know what kind of licensing they need and so on and so forth. I can't find them on the Internet. I'm sure everybody else was trying to do that at the same time I was. We can find, obviously, their address, but couldn't find any information, tagging it back, but they have one in Oklahoma, I noticed. So it must be a fairly big operation. And
Miss Coop, since you're in the environment, could you have your committee, you know, to look into that and give us a briefing, you know, what's causing their problem? You know, for many, many years, you know, over 40 years, you had the same smell, you know. It's been there, and also, Mary, if that's the case, can we look at our budget and see how can we clean that up and see why we're causing that? Cause, you know, I've been here 50 years, you know, it's been there ever since then and beyond. And sometimes in the summertime, you know, when it's dry, the odor is more. You tell us, man, you know, I don't know what it is, but I think we can look into it. And especially trying to get business coming across the southern section, also the Trent River involved, and we're going to be boating and like Dwayne said, you know, swimming or whatever in the Trent River, you know, and I see Dave shaking his head, you know, but what, we don't swim in the Trent River, okay, but we might fall off into the Trent River, so therefore, you know, we got to be safe, you know, so we need to look into that, you know. Thank you.
I'd go at that question even a little bit differently. What opportunities do we have to impact smells and that sort of thing? Again, it may or may not be harmful where Ms. Coop was going, but clearly it impacts the people that are in that area, as Mr. Carraway pointed out. What kind of opportunities do we have?
As it relates to the wastewater treatment plant, we in fact undertook a study years ago that came up with a series of recommendations which we have been...
Not the wastewater, but in terms of a particular standalone, private, non-city type of operation.
Not equipped to answer the question. Don't know what the ordinance requirements might be, but I've already asked someone to begin to look into it from a code perspective. Are there regulations in place and what can we do with rest of
And again, to Mr. Atkins, maybe the, and again, not now, but one, I think it'd be helpful if somebody could give us an overview again on the extent of our ordinances to be able to control something like that. And if we don't have that, do other cities have it? What are their similar? Two, in this specific instance, what's the emanation of the odor? Just as much background as you can. And then kind of the third thing is a marriage of one and two, and that is what sort of things can we do in those particular instances to encourage a little bit more environmentally friendly approach out of those facilities. And that may get at what you were going and both of you. So it may be actually better to do that, and then depending on what that comes up, then throw it over to Ms. Coop's committee, because part of it then would be less investigative of that, but more what actions we may need to take as a council to try to address these situations either there or in the future. Super. I appreciate it. Again. Thanks, Jody, for the presentation. I think what was made was clear by all of our colleagues. The water is an awfully big issue, and it's one of those that it can be one that is lost sight of, because the sort of things that happen in the next year, to be truthful, you have very little impact on what's happening. But again, when we go out 10 years, 20 years, it makes all the difference to having a viable and a vibrant region in this. We all know how important water is today, and I think we all understand that it's going to be even more so in the future. So that long-term focus, again, understanding that there's not a lot of focus sometimes on those actions today that mean so much in 50 years, we just appreciate the work that you do, and again, continue to encourage, especially the long-range issues. Appreciate that. Thank you. It's 11:30. My thought was, let's get started with the next briefing, and then depending on how the council wants to go, I was going to break between about 12 and 1, depending on when there's a nice convenient time for a lunch break, and then we'll pick it back up in the afternoon and finish whatever business we have. Does that make sense? Anybody have alternative suggestions? Just one until we finish. What do people want to do? Three, four, five, six, seven, eight. Yeah, we do. Yeah. What are you folks? Work through lunch, break at lunch. Any strong? Well, we've got two more briefings, and then we've got an item for individual consideration that should be relatively quickly. Mary, you want to estimate the time on the. On the health benefit plans, and then the legal options should be true.
Probably 20 minutes, 15, 20 minutes.
Okay, well, why don't we hit this now? And then my sense is take a break, but if anybody wants to work through, then throw it up at that time. We'll keep going. Please, you're up.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor and council members. I promise to brief you within the time frame given, but to try to provide you all the details as requested.
To be noted, very easy the time frame. Okay. Not
very. As we look at the employee and retiree health care briefing, there is a lot of information included. We'll be covering today, historically, on page 2, the national overview of health care, what our budget and cost-sharing model looks like, has looked like in the past, what our current plan options are, what our proposed changes shall be, and then also appendix has a number of detailed charts that will help you understand some feedback from our employees. As we look at our organization, we have to compare ourselves to other large organizations with our healthcare plan structure. The city of Dallas has more than 500 employees, and the average employer that has more than 500 employees self-insures rather than having a fully insured plan. The cost differential of having a fully insured plan sort of peaks at a point of 500 employees. Internally, as we're self-insured, we collect contributions based on previous established rates from the employees and retirees, and also from the departments as we look at our cost-sharing model. From time to time, although we haven't seen it in the past several years, claims may fall short of the actual contribution, and in that case, The city has the responsibility of assuming the risk, but also projecting what future costs may be and using those dollars to offset. In most cases, with most employers, and what we've seen in the past year, claims are generally higher than the contributions. And in that case, there are several options that you have to consider. But by far, the greatest option is either decreasing the benefit coverage or an increase in the premiums. On page 4, you will see that the City of Dallas has two main partners. United Healthcare serves as the city's third-party administrator, and they have the responsibility of paying the city's claims, negotiating with the healthcare providers in a network, and also contracting with the pharmaceutical benefit manager who manages our prescription plan. We also have a consultant that conducts actuarial studies on our claims and also evaluates the performance of the third-party administrator. These are critical partners as we are self-insured. On page 5, what I'd like to do is share with you just a little bit of history to look back in time to kind of share with you what we've done over the past couple of years. For the past several years, going back to fiscal year 2004-05, premium rates for employees and retirees participating in the PPO plan options have not changed. They have not increased. Now, we did have one year where we transitioned from a fully insured plan that was administered by Blue Cross and Blue Shield to what we call the, which was an HMO plan, and we transitioned to an exclusive provider option, which is an HMO lookalike. And in that case, the premiums for employees participating in that plan did increase. When you look back and you look at the changes that we've made, particularly going back a couple of years, we've made some. This is one of the ways that we help to control costs. In 2006, for example, we increased the emergency room copay, and that was to encourage employees to use more urgent care facilities. We also work with our retirees and found that if those who are over 65 participated in the AARP plan, they would have much better benefits at a reasonable rate compared to what the city was offering. In 2007, we looked at our prescription copay structure, and again, we also established the exclusive provider organization. But how does the City of Dallas compare to other large organizations? Well, on page 7, you will see that there are a number of things happening with the healthcare industry. It's expected by within the next several years, by 2014, healthcare expenditures will reach $3.6 trillion. That is a daunting number. And as you look at it compared to the gross domestic product by 2014, it will reach 18.7% of the GDP. Now, if you go forward on page 8, what I'd like to even show you some more startling statistics by looking at it all the way out to 2015, it is expected to reach 19.2% of the gross domestic product. And when you look at the chart to your bottom right on page 8, you'll see that the per capita cost per employee or per retiree, that cost is expected to get up right around $12,000 per. So these are tremendous numbers. We're looking at some increasing healthcare cost rates no matter which way we turn. On page 9, we found this chart as the Centers of Medicare and Medicaid provided it, and it showed just how healthcare expenditures were broken out for every dollar spent. And as you can see, 74% or 74 cent is wrapped up into three categories: hospital costs, physician and clinical service costs, and prescription costs. These are the three driving factors, but I also want to point out to you, to the far right, that the administrative costs have also increased, and it's at 14 cents, whereas you would have compared it to 15 years ago, it was somewhere right around 8 or 10%. So all costs of health care are going up. So the question becomes, on page 10, what can we do as an organization to contain or to cap our costs? Well, to be honest with you, there's very little we can do to contain the costs. What we can do is mitigate and avoid as much as we can. When you look at the chart, you'll see that the number one way to mitigate costs is to change the plan designs. You have to look at the benefits in order to do that. The second way to do it is to help employees understand what their current health status is. We reported to you back in June that 188 of our employees, and I should say participants, in 2007 comprised 47% of the total medical costs. And so we have to help all of our participants understand what their health status is. And then finally, the other option that we have, which represents 20% of the time, is to increase the contributions. On page 11, as we think about more strategies on looking at our health plan designs, one of the things that we're now proposing, which a number of employers are proposing, it's been reported by the Watch and Wyatt that 55% of U.S. corporations plan on offering some form of consumer-driven health care. Consumer-driven health care is pretty much a formulated plan that really encourages the participants to understand health care costs, their health status, and to participate in avoiding future risk. The other factor that we are recommending, and we'll talk about it a little bit more, is the fact that wellness is a critical component of consumer-driven healthcare, and so we're proposing to implement an on-site healthcare clinic. Now, the on-site healthcare centers serve as a significant leverage point to improve the adoption of employer-sponsored consumer-driven initiatives, but it also is designed to help employees, their dependents, and retirees and their dependents understand their current healthcare status by receiving screenings and treatment. On page 12, as we look at what the city is looking to implement, we're looking to implement a health reimbursement account. A health reimbursement account, quite frankly, is not new. It is an IRS-regulated plan. It's sponsored by the employer. In that case, it would be the City of Dallas. And it allows participants to receive reimbursement for eligible out-of-pocket health care expenses. It has been proven that over time, HRA plans is designed to encourage members to utilize their preventative care benefits. And that's what we're driving here at the City of Dallas. The benefits to employees, they're pretty straightforward. Again, employees are encouraged to become more aware of their health status. The HR account allows employees to roll dollars over that are unused from one year to the next, and we're going to talk more about that. And then finally, it really creates a partnership between the participant and the employer. And that is also important as we move forward. On page 15, I would like to share with you a little bit about the historical perspective of our budget. If you would look on page 15, you'll see in yellow in your booklets the four-year history of healthcare cost total. You'll see, surprisingly, the city has been able, in partnership with employees and retirees, to keep costs pretty flat. Fiscal year 04-05, I should say fiscal year 04-05 and 05-06, our costs remained at $88.7 million. There was an increase in 06-07 as well as the current fiscal year, but if you look down through the chart, that increase did not impact the employees or retirees. It was an increase, minor increase, that the city encumbered. However, when we look forward, if we don't change anything, if we don't modify our benefits or increase the rates, we're expected to see an increase from $90.2 million to the next fiscal year of $102.4 million. Now, we have found a solution, which is the health reimbursement account, which would help us to offset some of that, and so we're looking at a projected budget of $99.4 million. At the bottom, we're also showing you that our cost-sharing model over those 4 years has been the city paying 54% of the total costs and employees and retirees paying 46% on average. On page 16, we wanted to know just how we compare with our cost-sharing model. And not to our surprise, most other cities in Texas, as well as the DART system and also the City of Phoenix, has a tremendously different cost-sharing model. The average for all of those combined is, as the employer or sponsor, they're paying on an average of 78%, and the employees and retirees split the 22%. We're proposing that for the next fiscal year, our cost-sharing model, that the city pays a little bit more than the previous 4 years, that it goes up to 56% compared to the employees and retirees paying 44%. On page 17, as you think about the cost-sharing models, then the question becomes, well, what do we need to consider if we want it to be closer to the average of those employers statewide? And this chart will show you that if we remain at the 56-44% split, that it wouldn't have an impact. But as you consider the 75-25, meaning the employer would pay 75% and the retirees and employees would pay 25%, you can see that that may have an impact to the tax rate, or it may have an impact in some form to the budget itself. And of course, if you wanted to look at other options going across the board, the more we share, the more it will cost us in some form. This is a pretty significant chart because obviously employees and retirees believe that the cost-sharing model should be a little different. But the question is, how do we pay for it? On page 19, we wanted to show you what our current plan options are, and I'm sure many of you are aware of these plans as most of you participate, but we currently have 7 plan options. And nearly 48% of our employees and retirees participate in one main plan, and that is the 80-20 plan with a $1,000 deductible. Overall, when we look at the PPO options, 87% of our employees are participating in one of the varied PPO options. And then we have 13% of our employees participating in the EPO plan, which is the HMO lookalike. On page 21, we want to talk to you about proposed changes to the plans. Right now, we have 7 plans, and we are proposing to reduce those plan options to 3. Now, what that means from a participant standpoint is, yes, their selection option would be less, but as, again, you go to the previous chart, although you don't need to turn it to that, you will find, again, that 48% of our employees are participating in one plan overall. We're also looking to introduce, again, the health reimbursement account, and we're going to walk you through an example about how that health reimbursement account will work, but we're also looking to maintain one of our PPO plan options, which has a $3,000 deductible, and the cost sharing on that plan is 70-30. And then finally, we are looking to maintain our self-insured EPO plan, which is really, again, the HMO lookalike. One of the more exciting things that we hope to introduce is an on-site clinic. And we have gotten a lot of feedback, one, from other municipalities and also from other employers who have implemented an on-site clinic, and it's been overwhelmingly positive. And we know from data that employees also have said to us that this is something that they would want. We're looking to house this on-site clinic right here in City Hall, at least in the first year. And then future years, we're looking to figure out ways that we can expand this clinic. On page 22, as we think about 48% of our employees currently participating in the PPO plan, one of the PPO plan options, particularly the $1,000 deductible, we thought it prudent to really compare the different components of the PPO plan to the proposed HRA plan. And really, when you look at it, there's only one significant difference, and that is the city is going to allocate a $1,000 or $2,000 credit to a participant up front. And we're going to talk about how that works, but I wanted to show you that, for the most part, the PPO plan option, as we have been using for a number of years, the components of it don't differ really from that of an HRA, with the exception of one component. On page 23, we have found over the past year that a number, really several years, a number of our employees are not familiar with the flexible spending account. If you are familiar with it, it's no news to you that a flexible spending account is a tax shelter that employees can use to set aside dollars for their medical expenses. If you're not familiar with it, there mechanically are a number of things that it can do to benefit you to offset your costs. But the greatest benefit for the city of Dallas is that the way we set aside the money for employees, they can use the total amount that they earmarked day one of the plan year, which is January 1, and pay towards the total set aside over a 24 pay period plan. This has been beneficial to employees who have used it. We hope to really educate more employees about it, because as they use the HRA plan, it will help to cover some of the gap costs that they would have in their new deductible. So how just does the HRA plan work? Well, on page 24, we have talked to a number of employees thus far in about 40 to 50 different sessions, and we have used this example, and so we'd like to share it with you. We're assuming that an employee by the name of Jose, who is fairly healthy, has elected to use the health reimbursement account. He's using it for himself as an employee only, and so the way it would work, if you remember the components on page 22, he first would have an allocation of $1,000. So Jose, throughout the year, he spends $125 on prescription costs. He receives the free preventative care that we're now introducing to all who participate in this plan. And the value of that preventative care cost is approximately $750. He also visits the doctor, or may have visited an urgent care facility, and he charged $200 to the plan. And overall, he spent $1,075 to the healthcare plan. Now let's figure out how the costs were paid under Jose's account. Well, first, the preventative care is free, and it's not charged to the $1,000 allocation. It is a cost that the city pays. So it's free to Jose, but it is a cost to the city. The prescription plan, where he spent $125, is charged to his allocation of $1,000, as well as his other expenses of $200. Overall, again, if you look at the bottom, Jose charged to the plan $1,075. But he only charged $325 to his allocation. And so what that means is, under the HRA plan, whatever amount of allocation is unused, for example, in this year, then it rolls forward and it becomes a part of his allocation in the following fiscal year.
And it's, just to be very clear, it's credit, not cash.
That's correct.
It's credit in his account.
And to be more specific about the credit, if employees were to leave our organization, they would not be able to take that credit with them. They have to stay with the plan to keep it. There's a second example on page 25. It operates the same. I will keep within the 20-minute timeline. I won't go through it. But as you can see, that example operates the same way. The only difference is this is an employee who now has his spouse on the plan, and the allocation increased from $1,000 to $2,000. But other than that, it operates just the same. And hopefully at some point you will walk through that example to better understand it if it applies to you. On page 26 is the chart that we have been fighting dearly with our consultants and working numerous hours to try to get an understanding on, and that is our proposed rates for the next fiscal year. If you were to look at the top chart, the current rates of 2007-2008, which is the current year that we will end, from left to right you will see the plan options, which there are seven. In the first set of blue charts you will see the current cost that the city and the participant is paying per plan. And then in the middle, in the white area, you will see the rate that the city subsidizes each plan per option. And then finally, at the top chart, which is equivalent to the bottom, you will see the actual premium rate that the participant pays per plan option. So as an example, if an employee was participating in the $300 deductible 80-20 PPO plan, the current rate the city and the participant is paying for the employee only is $352. The city is subsidizing that amount at $221. And the premium rate on a monthly basis for that participant, to your far right, employee only, is $131. As you look at the current rate chart, then I'm going to ask you to go down to the second chart at the bottom of the page to look at the newly proposed rates. You will see that it operates the same way. The difference is there are less plan options from 7 to 3. If you were to look at the employee only, yes, ma'am, it's $75 per month for the HRA plan. So if we were to look at the example, just to be clear, Ms. Davis, the HRA plan total cost for employee only is $359 per month. The city is subsidizing $284, and the participant will pay $75 per month. So yes, $900 per year in premium. On page 27, you will see that there is a similar chart or two charts for our retirees under the age of 65. The mechanical operations of how it works is exactly the same. And so currently, retirees participating in the $300 deductible 80-20 plan, the total cost for the city and the participant is $902. The city subsidized with $451, and the premium for retirees is $451. We know that the chart is rather busy, but we thought it was important to share with you all the math that equates to it, because it's not simply a premium rate. We have to look at the total cost, what the city subsidizes, and then what the employee or retiree pays. So we wanted to show you the detail. On page 28, we're looking at another change to our plan. There is an error that I want to point out on this chart. But for the most part, when we look at our retirement qualifications for, I'll just use civilian employees, for example, there are three ways you can retire. Your age plus your years of service has to equate to a rule of 78, that you turn age of 70, or that you have 30 years of experience. I'm sorry, what did I say? I'm sorry, I wanted to increase it. It's 60. Don't mean to alarm anyone, it is 60. But what we're finding is that a number of retirees who are retiring from other sectors look at our benefit options and say, I can come at the age of 55, work for the city for 5 years, turn 60 years of age, and receive 100% of benefit coverage. That is compared to an employee who has worked with the city for 30 years. So what we wanted to do was to create a graduating scale that said, if you work for the city for less than 20 years of service, then we're going to create a ladder for you. The error in the chart is, when you look at the tiers, there are four tiers. The fourth tier is an error. The fourth tier is not 21 plus years of service. It's 20 plus years of service. 20 plus years of service, yes, sir. So if you work for less than any day less than 20 years of service and you decided to retire, we're proposing to provide you coverage according to the percentages indicated. On page 29, we began to talk to you a little bit more, or share with you information a little bit more about the on-site clinic. There are several goals that we're hoping to accomplish, but again, the most important goal is to help employees and the dependents understand their health status. The on-site clinic that we're hoping to house here in City Hall will provide treatment in the areas of common illnesses. It will also provide preventative screening, and finally, physical exams and vaccinations. On page 30, we do apologize. We realize that the font is not very clear. But we wanted to show you that there are four levels of services that we're looking to provide with this on-site clinic. And we're looking to provide it for employees, whether they are currently participating in our healthcare plan, or depending on the options, whether it's the HRA plan, the EPO plan, or the $3,000 deductible. But by far, what's important is the four different levels. Level one, we have learned, and particularly for employees who decide that they have those special deadlines that they have to meet on a given weekday or workday, that they're coming to work in some cases with illnesses. And so what we want to do is to be able to have an on-site area that treats those common illnesses. You will see a whole list in the yellow area of what the clinic is proposing to treat, and they are almost equivalent to any urgent care facility that which you would go to. When you look at level two, you'll see that we're actually providing preventative care in the way that a healthcare plan that offers a health reimbursement account would provide. And so you see a well woman's exam, a well men's exam. The one thing that I do want to point out, as you look at the areas that's included in those exams, we're still working with United Healthcare, our partners, to finalize it, but for the most part, we believe we're 98% complete, which is what will all be included. Now, we do have approximately 1,500 employees who are not participating in our healthcare plan. And as you look at level two and you go over to what the actual cost would be for those particular employees, we're saying that they can receive a well woman's or well men's exam for a mere $25. Now, if you were to compare that to an urgent care facility, it's roughly $54 to $60 for that same service. So we're still offering a benefit to employees who are not participating in our plan. Level three basically focuses in on after employee learns what their health status is through the screenings or through the common illness evaluation, they may be referred out to their own provider or to a provider of their choice. And level four is an added value benefit that our partners United Healthcare is providing to all of our employees as it relates to the on-site clinic. In summary, on page 32, again, there are five areas that we're truly recommending. One, the benefit plan design changes will reduce from 7 to 3. Two, that we would introduce a consumer-driven healthcare option, which is the health reimbursement account. Three, to establish the on-site preventative care clinic for our employees and retirees and all their dependents. And four, that we would create a new cost-sharing model, increasing the city's cost from 54% to 56%. And then finally, to establish the proposed premium rates for 2009. On page 33, if you would like to look at the details of how the three plan options work, they're a little bit more involved than what we have shared before, but it gives you a comparison. And we have found this chart has helped employees thus far to understand the differences. And so with that, Mr. Mayor, I turn it back over.
Let's come back into session. And what I'm going to ask, we had the initial presentation on the benefits. I'm going to ask you, if you would, just to hold questions on that. Mr. Atkins, Ms. Davis, and Ms. Coop had asked to continue the discussion on that one. What I would ask is that we hold off for just a moment on that. There's a short briefing that has to do with some of the requirements that we have as to the budget. I'm going to ask Mr. Cook, if you would. Dave, would you go ahead and do that presentation? We'll come back, vote on the item, then we'll come back to the questions and discussion on the benefits, and then we'll have the last briefing. But given trying to get that done today, let's go ahead and move that around, and if there's no objections, I'm going to have Mr. Cook start.
Okay.
Dave, go ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Behind tab D in your book is the briefing on the tax rate and the legal options that are in front of us. These are all spelled out in the state law. The law, as I mentioned 2 weeks ago when we presented the budget, the law requires various public notice of tax rate calculations, and in certain circumstances it may allow taxpayers to petition and call an election that could perhaps roll back a tax rate that is imposed by a jurisdiction, whether that be a county or city or school. Some of the calculations that we have to do are the effective tax rate calculation. In simple terms, it is the tax rate that would be needed to generate the same amount of revenue in the new year as the same property was taxed and generated the previous year. The rollback rate gets a little more complicated. It separates the tax rate into two pieces. First is the debt service. It simply allows you to set a tax rate, the calculation anyway, sets the tax rate at what is needed to pay your debt, to pay your principal and interest. In our case, it's that $246 million number. And it also looks at the general fund portion of the tax rate and allows for an 8% increase from the previous year. And the calculation, the results of the calculation are shown on slide 5. And it calculates to be 76.18 cents. The law defines that the notice and hearing rate is then the lower of the two rates I just spoke about, the effective rate or the rollback rate. The notice and hearing rate is the lower of those two. And in this case, it's the effective rate. That becomes the notice and hearing rate at 71.88 cents. Slide 7 then starts, it goes through the detail of what steps must be followed in order to consider a tax rate higher than that 71.88 cents. And a reminder, our recommended tax rate is 74.79 cents. So it is higher than this notice and hearing rate. The recommended rate is lower than the rollback rate, but higher than this notice and hearing. So the steps that are outlined...
And the same is the rate that's in place today.
It's current rate, yes, sir. It's the 74.79 is the current rate as well. So the steps on page 7 must be followed in order to be able to adopt a rate eventually that's higher than 71.88 cents. We'd start today with a record vote that would consider... leave open for consideration a rate higher than the 71.88 cents. It has to be a specific rate that's voted on today and a record vote. We would publish in the paper the results of that record vote as well as today's action calls two separate public hearings just on the tax rate. We have an overall budget public hearing on the agenda for Wednesday this week. This action today calls two additional public hearings specific on the tax rate. So we would then hold those public hearings, publish a notice of the revenue and the time that we would set the tax rate in September, and later actually vote on the tax rate. There are other requirements that aren't detailed here, such as information we must place on the city's website, display on the city's cable channel, and various ads regarding those public hearings to notify the public as well. So the tax rate scenarios on page 8, the current tax rate is 74.79. That is our proposed rate as well. The calculated effective rate, 71.88, and that becomes our notice and hearing rate as well. And the rollback rate is 76.18 cents. To give you a sense of the magnitude of what these rates do and what they are, if the council opted today to not vote for considering a tax rate at higher than 71.88 cents, we would then be limited to 71.88 cents as our tax rate as we move through the rest of August and September. That would necessitate a need for a decrease on the revenue side of $25 million without a successful vote today of something above 71.88. On the other end of the spectrum, consideration of a tax rate up to the rollback rate would generate an additional $12 million in revenue.
Council has the freedom or flexibility to vote on an even higher rate than the rollback. That's not the end of the parameter, but it would an adoption of a rate higher than the rollback rate would leave ourselves subject to potential for petition, and as outlined on page 9, petition of at least 10% of the registered voters. We'd have some time to validate those petitions and call an election within 90 days. And if that rollback election were successful, on page 10, the adopted tax rate that was set in September would be rolled back to that rollback rate of 76.18 cents. All of that's a scenario is if the council were to go above the manager's recommended budget and above the 76.18 cents. So the schedule that we have before us is an actual record vote on your agenda today that would be not setting the tax rate, but it does set the ceiling, if you will. Whatever rate is voted today, and we would go through the remaining parts of the process, that becomes the ceiling, and the council could not later choose to adopt a higher tax rate. So the item that's posted today is drafted and recommended that the vote be for 74.79 cents. That's the rate recommended by the manager. That's the current tax rate. And then that would allow the council the option, leave open the option of adopting a rate up to that number, but not exceeding 74.79. And obviously the council could, through the coming weeks, come to adopt a lower tax rate than 74.79. Schedule of the publications and public hearings is on page 14, and with that, I'll conclude and turn it back to the mayor.
Thank you, Dave. Mr. Newman, please. Webb, do you want to have something on the floor before comments are made?
That
mayor,
would probably or be the West. If people would be willing to hold the question,
sure.
What I'd suggest is our secretary to read the item in, because that's really where the discussion is going to be. Then we'll go ahead and discuss it when we get it. So if you would, Deborah, if you would, Jeff.
Okay. Item number one is authorized, number one, a public hearing to be held on September the 10th, 2008 and September the 15th, 2008 to receive comments on proposed tax rate, and two, a proposal to consider adoption of a 74.79 cents per 100 valuation tax rate or a lower rate as may be proposed by the City Council on September the 24th, 2008.
Thank you. Okay, with that, it's in the record, Mr. Newman.
In order to make my comments germane, I move approval.
Appreciate it. It's been moved and seconded by Mr. Carraway. Go ahead, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you, Mayor, Council members. First of all, thank you to the manager for doing a good job in presenting us a budget proposal that has as its baselines a no tax increase. It's very. I've had three town hall meetings now. I have our fourth tonight down in Mountain Creek, and the feedback thus far has been generally positive. Citizens have the expectation that the services, the police protection, code compliance, parks, recreation, are all things they depend on, and we've conveyed to them that we're going to improve, maintain, and or improve. So that's very important, and I'm appreciative of that. There have been some suggestions that I've heard thus far about better ways to improve things. They're anxious about code compliance. They're anxious about neighborhood policing, these 200 additional police officers that we're funding, getting them back into the neighborhoods, and we're reassuring them over and over that is clearly where we're headed. So I'm supportive of this today because it says to the citizens, as they're holding their budgets tight, we are too, and I think that's very important. Question for the manager. When will the council receive a review? When are you going to review the tax revenues that you originally proposed as far as your assumptions? When are you going to review the assumptions? Up, down, sideways?
You're talking about when am I going to be looking at all revenues?
Yep.
Updating them? It'll probably be week after next.
Okay.
Two weeks.
Okay, the risk I see today in us approving this is we're locking ourselves into no higher than the existing 74 and change, correct?
Yes.
So if for some reason
you came back to us and said that your assumptions would be dramatic less, we'd be handcuffed. So you're relatively confident that when you go back and review your assumptions that it won't be a precipitous drop?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Do you anticipate an increase?
An increase in
revenues? Revenue sources. You handed out that sheet the other day that
they
were crazy. There were some viable alternatives.
No, reviewing revenues does not include suggesting new programs on my part. You have my budget.
Okay.
What we'll be doing is looking at the revenues included in my recommended budget to see, you know, it will have been 30, 45 days
yes.
to see where they are. We have gotten one sales tax check that was better than we projected. We will buy electricity in, I think, the end of the month, the 27th to 28th. So as we begin to, you know, I have a little more information on the revenues, and I will give that to you in 2 weeks.
So September, just put a date, like
10th, somewhere in there.
In that neighborhood, yes, yeah. I think that's okay, so fair. September 10th, we should get an update on your revenue.
Yes.
Okay. So anyway, yes, sir.
And, you know, I would also interject. I think part of the answer to your question is ongoing, because clearly the softness in the economy is going to put that question of sales tax. You could have some large variability in that throughout the course of the year.
Yeah, and that's, and I think our estimate reflects that. And being below 2% growth.
Well,
we're concerned about that one.
And I'll close on this. I'm very pleased that we're headed in the direction we are. As you know, tomorrow FNA, and then soon the council's beginning, going to review DFW's airport budget, and they're holding their expenses at $640 million. They're tightening their belt, and well, they are, and other the county's holding their belt, and others are. So I think it's part of our responsibility to hold our belt as well. I don't let a taxpayer get fooled to saying there's no tax increase, because the value of homes in Dallas is averaging increased by, what, 7%?
Mm-hmm.
Is that correct?
Well, that's the total growth of our tax base.
Okay.
Nearly about a third of that is new construction.
Oh, well.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that would be a good number then, Mary. What is the average residential property value increase? Is that obtainable? Is that...
Yes.
I've been quoting 7%, but it's not, you're saying.
We'll do that. I suspect it would be less. It's less than 7%. We'll get that.
Okay, that would be a valid number, because I want to make sure they equate the two.
Okay.
Thank you, Mayor. The other interesting number on the expense side is the budget's up 1.62%. So regardless of what inflation factor you look at, it's below the inflation factor.
And you're getting a lot of additional things.
Absolutely.
For that very small increase in size.
What's the net increase dollars? Is it $23 million?
43.
I think it's 42, 40, 43.
43 million. Okay, thank you, Mayor.
Which equates to 1.62.
Yeah, 1.6%.
Mr. Wazowski, please.
Mr. Mayor, thank you.
Dave?
Good afternoon.
Hi.
Dave, there's a differential of 2.91 cents between the current rate and the effective rate, or the 74.79 in the notice of hearing. There's 2.91 cents. I guess if you multiply that by 8.3 million per cent, that's how you came up with 25 million.
It's about 8.8 million.
Well, you know, whatever, yeah. 8 points. Yeah, 3 to 20. That's right. And if we found that, there would not. And if we found that $25 million, what would happen to our tax rate?
If you found $25 million,
yeah,
expense,
say the good fairy
came
down in here, wrote out a check. For
the council could have the option to lower the tax rate, or enhance services. Or
that's correct. Thank you. Colleagues, I will not support this. I have to be consistent. It's pretty obvious we need $25 million. We're not. We would go back to what rate would we go back to if somebody came down with $25 million?
It could lower the tax rate to the 71.88 cents.
That's correct. I will not support this. We had $1.5 billion on our budget of non-salaried expenses, more or less. Is that about right, Dave? About $1.5 billion,
yeah,
more
I,
or less.
I wouldn't disagree. Yes.
Yeah, and if we went to each department, cut off 2%, less than 2%, that would we would pick up that $25 to $30 million. So I just cannot support this, and I need to bat 1,000 since here, because I just would not support this.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dave. Thank you so much,
Mr. Tiske.
And real quick, the mayor. Dave, if we lowered it as
has been suggested and we don't find the savings, we then would not have an alternative.
If the council took no vote today or took
Correct.
A no vote on the motion,
right.
we would be restricted come September 24th to a tax rate no higher than 71.88 cents.
Right. If we do this, though, and by some miracle, as the good fairy brings us some money, we still have the option of not going through with it. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. The council would still have the option of adopting a rate lower than 74.79 cents.
I mean, I knew the answer. I was just getting you to say it publicly there. So, you know, I'll be supporting this, Mr. Mayor. I think it's a fiscally responsible thing to do is to give us the options and go forward. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It's been moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Mr. Mayor, for the record, there has to be a roll call vote, I understand, on this item. So we need to go back and do a roll call vote, starting first with Mayor Pro Tem Garcia, and she's absent today. Councilmember Medrano, and she's absent today. Councilmember Newman.
Yes.
Deputy Mayor Pro Tem Carraway?
Yes.
Councilmember Hill?
Yes.
Councilmember Salazar is absent. Councilmember Davis is absent on the vote. Councilmember Atkins?
Yes.
Councilmember Kadane?
Yes.
Councilmember Allen?
Yes.
Councilmember Coop?
Yes.
Councilmember Natinsky?
Yes.
Councilmember Rizansky? Councilmember Hunt?
Yes.
Mayor Leppard?
Yes.
Motion passes, Mayor.
Thank you very much. With that, then, let's go back, then, to any questions that we have in regard to the benefits. As I mentioned, Mr. Atkins, Ms. Davis, and Ms. Coop had expressed desire to make some comments on that. So, Mr. Atkins, could I start with you?
Thank you, Mayor. The city cleaning, Mayor, how much is it going to cost us?
About $600,000 is our estimate.
We're bidding.
We will just bid it and somebody else will do it. It will be like emergency clinic that's out on the corners in the strip centers. That's what it will be like.
Have we identified the space?
Yes.
So everything is ready?
Everything, we're doing a bid right now.
Okay, and the timeline?
Our aim is to open up January 1, when our insurance runs January 1 to December 31st, so it's our goal to open up January 1st.
So if we do not open up January 31st, what is
January January 1st.
January 1st.
We will open.
Mm-hmm. We will open.
We'll
up.
Open.
We keep talking about the 56% that what a city paid and the average with other cities is like 78% or 74%.
Correct.
Is there any way that we would try to ease up to that average because we're self-insured? Or are we looking down the road?
Yeah.
Well, I think the best thing to do, Ms. Atkins, to answer your question is what we gave you on page 16 shows you what other municipalities and other industries have as a cost-sharing model. But I would tell you the city manager organized a total compensation team to include a number of private sector organizations, benefit administrators. And when they saw our cost-sharing model, what they asked us was, how did we get there? Because they had a desire to get there as well. So as you talk about the thought of increasing our cost-sharing model, technically we've done that. Again, over the past 4 years, it's been 54%. We're now recommending to go to 56%. But if you're asking how do we get towards the municipality average, that would be a question or a decision that this council would have to make.
I guess, City Manager, do you see that we are trying to get to the average, or because we're self-insured, we should not be worried about trying to get to that average? What do you see? We see 5 years from now.
I see us about where we are right now. I see other cities approaching our average in our relationship. That's the way the business is going.
In layman terms, you know, the average of other cities is 78%. So we had 56. So
I think other cities will be coming down.
So they're going to be coming down?
Yes, I do. Because the costs are getting so high that You know, the thing that's interesting about this program is that we're asking the employees to, it's a consumer-driven program. You're going to have to think about which covers you best, to be sure and use a medical savings account, to look at which plan you choose. You know, some plans are better if most of your expenses are in medications. Other plans are better if you think you're going to the hospital a lot. And we're going to be there to help people with this training and their decisions, but it becomes a consumer-driven plan. And we want to encourage that and prevention because over the long haul, since we are self-insured, we all have to begin taking care of ourselves so that our costs are less over the long haul.
So would you say it's the first statement said that the employees of the city of Dallas that you feel like we are going the right direction to make sure that our health costs is down compared to the average overall?
On the prevention side, absolutely. The things that we're putting in place are to kind of hold those costs over the long term. It's right there on the paper. You can see that other cities do pay more than we do, but I think those are decisions of balancing of budgets and costs that we've made in the past, and I recommend what we have on the paper there, the 56%.
And again, I hear you correct. You said other cities probably going to reduce their...
Oh, yes. Yes. And the private sector, same thing.
Thank you.
Private sector is already there.
Thank you very much.
The only thing on that, Mr. Atkins, that I'd add to, and I think 16 actually can be misleading. The average is a simple arithmetic average. If you weighted it, it would be much closer to where we are because you've got two of the three largest cities are right in the 54, 56, 66 category. So if you weighted it by population, it'd be substantially below the 70 rate. With that, Ms. Coop, please.
A couple questions. Okay. First of all, about the health reimbursement account, which is sort of akin to a flexible spending account, but sort of in addition to that. In your example of Jose, who came in and then he had expended $385 out of the health reimbursement account, and then the rest of 600 and something rolled over to the next year. I think is what it was. Maybe I'm wrong just a little bit. But
no, you're very close. Jose spent $325.
Okay.
That was charged to the allocation.
Right. So the $675 rolled to the next year, and then did the city replenish it with another few hundred dollars to bring it back up to $1,000? Is that how it works,
or
it just continues to diminish?
No, actually, what would happen is, if he chose the same plan the following year,
right,
and there was a $1,000 credit allocation, now his allocation would increase from $1,000 to $1,675.
And the logic behind this is to ask people to think about their medical expenses in advance.
Mm-hmm.
And, you could look at scheduling major things. You may be able to break those years so that you will have the benefit of those two allocations. And it's talking about looking forward, thinking about your health and your health care needs.
Hmm. No, that's a pretty good deal. I mean, really that the city is going to be giving you, it's really in addition to your flexible spending account.
Well, your flexible spending account's yours. And this one is a credit.
But it's really kind of the same difference. I mean, you're spending it because you have a health problem, and you didn't pay for it. So, it's a pretty good deal. Do you have mail prescription service?
We do.
The question was, do we have a mail prescription service, which brings down, I've noticed, the total cost of your prescriptions on medication if you're taking them month after month after month. So you offer that service?
That's correct. If your physician prescribes medication to you, you may order up to 90 days worth of supply in advance with one copayment today.
Do you know if the majority of your employees who have to take medication every single month avail themselves of that? Because that's the education process.
It's really a low percentage of those who use the mail order.
Okay. Well, my suggestion is, and I don't have your insurance here at the city, but with our insurance, I've noticed that, you know, the more education you can give to your employees, it's better for them, it's easier, it's cheaper, it's, you can go online and do it, and or do it over the phone if you're not computer savvy, and it would, and I'm sure that it would help a lot of them, because it's only a $35 or $25 for a 3 month supply, rather than $25 every single month for 3 months. So you're reducing your out of pocket costs by half, and that is something that if your employees don't know about it, it's something that could be very helpful to them. Let's go on to the health clinic here for just a second. Have you done a cost analysis of the cost of the health clinic versus how much, you know, the marketplace would have been? You would have had to, I guess, how much your insurance would have actually had to pay for that kind of service through your PPO or your HMO? Is there some kind of analysis of the reason that you chose to go to the health clinic route? And I think the health clinic's great. I'm just asking a question.
No, it's a very good question. As the city manager had mentioned, we had looked at some preliminary estimates of what the clinic would cost us to provide these four levels of services, really three, because the fourth is done by UnitedHealthcare. And for the clinic, it will cost us an estimate of $600,000. Now, the number that you want to come...
A year.
Uh-huh. Per year. And that provides all the services that are listed on page 30.
Right, I saw that. Uh-huh.
But the number that you'd really want to focus in on is the value of what those services equate to. And level two alone equates to approximately $750 per participant.
And preventative. Now, if you can use it for other things too. The bottom line for me on this is that that figure that showed how many people we have driving our health care cost, and a lot of the things that we suffer from as a group, early detection would prevent later expense. High blood pressure and diabetes being a huge example.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, you can walk for years with high blood pressure and fall out and have a stroke, and I'm hoping that the clinic will have, you know, be able to call that to people's attention for free and begin the treatment program.
Well, my suggestion is, I know that it's difficult because of the HIPAA rules and so on and so forth, be able to quantify in broad brush strokes, you know.
Broad brush we probably can, but you're right, the HIPAA makes it very difficult.
That. Right. Yeah. You know, how many people came in and we detected that they had diabetes, that we detected
well,
them high blood pressure.
And we did, when we did that testing year before last, we did have numbers on that of how many folks we have with high blood pressure and diabetes. So, and it was scary.
Well, you know, and for next year's budget, I think it'd be good information to have.
Now, understand, we won't have but about 6 months worth of data because it starts in January.
Okay. And let me ask you, because I thought it was curious, that a person that is not on your health insurance can come to the clinic for free?
Mm-hmm.
Actually, well, I was going to say, for depending on the services that they ascertain, level two will cost them a $25 copay. But yes, the other levels are free.
Tell me what the other level. Give me an example of the other level. Like if a guy came in, he was complaining of sore throat, and it turned out he had strep throat.
Right.
Okay. You ran the test on him, gave him a prescription.
Correct.
Would that be covered for free?
The screening, the detection, the status is free. Once he goes to obtain that prescription, that's at a cost to him.
Let me make a suggestion to you, because I'm just saying, I don't have your insurance, though, but if one day I wasn't feeling well and I said I had strep throat and went down there, boy, I'd be really happy it was there, for one thing. But my insurance would pick up that cost, I think, of you doing the screening and so on and so forth. So my question would be to you is, if a person is a family member, part of our family in the city, whether it's, you know, whether they have insurance or not, when they come in, I would suggest that if they didn't have any insurance, that's fine. If we, some people choose not to have any insurance, I understand that. But if people have insurance, to go ahead and run that through, because I think that my insurance company would pick that up.
Because it's be a matter of inquiring as they come in. That's probably good.
Okay. I think that was it.
That was a good point.
Well, I'm reading through my notes. I think I'm through, but.
That's the one you want to go out on roll.
I think that's all.
Just kidding.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
I hope I'm not repetitive in when I left a couple minutes earlier, but David, can you very briefly, what's the difference between this and, I know you and I talked, there was an article, a couple articles in the paper with regard to, what do they call it, HSPs?
Health savings account.
Right.
HSA.
This seems to be kind of a, almost that, but not exactly. Can you sort of short, you know, very briefly explain the difference? Because it seems like a lot of private and corporate businesses are moving toward that along the same lines as what we're trying to do to incentivize employees to not just frivolously be spending health care dollars, but this doesn't seem to be everything that I understood they are, but maybe it is, and it's just under another, we called it something else.
Well, the difference, the health savings account, which you're referring to, and the health reimbursement account that we're proposing have some minor differences. The most significant is the health reimbursement account we're proposing, it's a credit. The employees have a $1,000 or $2,000 credit. If they decide to leave, that credit is dissolved. It stays with the city's self-insured account. The health savings account, however, that amount of money becomes portable and it's like cash. And so in the event that they leave the plan, resign, they can take that cash with them. The goal of having the HRA, as the city manager said earlier, is to encourage more preventative care. Both the HSA and the HRA encourage preventative care. They're similar in that nature. The only other difference that we've learned is the flexible spending account that we also want to encourage employees to use, it operates differently with the HSA versus the HRA, and it's more limited. The employee can only use it for voluntary benefits, whereas with the HRA, they can use it for medical expenses as well as
pharmaceutical. To put it another way, the way we're doing this is we're giving them in-store credit.
That's correct.
To spend on health care versus the other alternative or way it's done is
portable.
Giving them dollars and they can spend it whenever or however.
Okay. That's correct.
You've got your little MasterCard up there. I mean, is that the way the money's going to be, or is that just symbolic up there?
No, it's a good question. This MasterCard we currently have in place now for the flexible spending account.
Okay.
Totally separate from the HRA. And employees can deposit up to $5,000 per year on this account and use it to pay for any medical or prescription costs they may have.
So is their credit going to be put on something like that?
Not for the HRA,
okay.
No.
All right.
The HRA will operate very similar as a checking account. There's no card. There's no debit card for it. You just basically, as you use it, there's a debit.
Internally, we're going to debit down.
UnitedHealthcare is going to administrate it for us.
Yeah,
that's
okay. Are there any significant changes to, because somewhere on one of the slides you're talking about out-of-network and in-network, are they basically staying, or are they staying the same as the list of providers? Because, you know, people that are going to Dr. A don't necessarily want to have to be forced to go to Dr. B because we changed the list of providers.
The good news is the PPO plans that we have in place has a very large network, and it covers nearly 98% of the providers that our employees use. That network will remain in place for the three plans we're implementing in 2009.
Okay, so there shouldn't be any surprises.
No disruptive analysis.
From the employees who are going to doctors. Okay.
Correct.
This plan, this menu and all this, somebody mentioned it earlier, you know, you've got to pick your plan and go through it. It reminds me of trying to pick, you know, if you're on Medicare, and I'm not, but helping somebody through that, picking their pharmacy. And it is not easy, all right? What are we going to have internally that are going to, that employees can take advantage of to help them work through this so that we minimize the chances that they make the wrong choice? I mean, in the end, the choice is theirs, but this is not an easy thing to decide because historically you may not have been ill. You may make a choice based on that, and it may not be the best choice for your future health needs. So what are we going to do internally, and how accessible and easy is it going to be for the employees who want to come in and have a, let's call it a consultation, to work through what plan they ought to get on?
Well, we have about 3 to 4 strategies that we're putting in place. One we've already begun to implement, that is to really educate as many employees as we possibly can on how the HRA plan works compared to the other two. Second, we're going to start the enrollment process a little bit sooner with your approval today. We hope to start in the first week of September versus waiting to October or November. And during the enrollment, the third thing we're going to do is we're going to have a worksheet. And the worksheet will be designed in such a way that any employee or participant will be able to plug in their factors and help them to determine what the best plan will be based on their anticipated outcome. And you're right, Mr. Natisky, we can't always predict the future, but we have found through our partners with UnitedHealthcare that that's the strategy to go. And then finally, the fourth thing we're going to do, after January 1, UnitedHealthcare is going to be working with us to continue the education one-on-one to help employees understand this paradigm change, because it is a change of how you communicate with your doctors and also how you project future costs.
Okay, two more quick questions. These, I'm going to call them rollover credits.
Mm-hmm.
Do they roll over as long as the employee is participating in the plan, or is it only 1 year, or what are the limitations? Because, you know, if an employee uses a little bit, as, you know, you illustrated, you know, Jose uses part of it, the rest of it rolls over as a credit for him to use next year. So if he's got more medical needs, he's got more dollars that he can deal with it. What happens on the third year? Does it keep rolling over as long as we keep the plan within these parameters? Or does he just lose it at some point?
As long as the employee stays with the plan, as long as the city maintains the HRA plan itself, that employee will be able to roll dollars over based on the original allocation. But there is a cap. The cap is, for a single coverage, $6,000. It takes 6 years to get there. If you didn't use your plan for 6 years, you get $6,000 in a credit form. Or if you are employee plus spouse or employee plus family, it could be up to $12,000, considering the allocation is $2,000. So as long as they stay in the plan, they keep the credit. If they exit the plan and go to another option, the credit goes away, they start over.
Okay, but aren't there multiple places within the plan that those credits can be used?
Well, we have one HRA plan.
Only the one?
Only the one. Okay. Now, within the HRA plan, depending on which year, the first year you may say, I'm using single coverage. That's fine. That's your allocation. It rolls over. Second year, you come back and say, well, I want to add my spouse on.
Okay.
You're able to keep your credits that way. But if you leave the HR plan
and go to one of the other plans,
go to another
and come back,
it's dissolved.
It's dissolved. Okay. And last, let me talk a little bit about this, the clinics, because I see some good uses there, and I'm not sure. Let me start off with this. Is this a in-person physical clinic, or are we going to have the availability of people calling into the clinic and talking to, you know, whoever's there? I mean, I'm going to call it a nurse line. I had insurance previously that had this, and that was their way of lowering the cost of the premium. So that if you were home and you were sick, you called in, you gave somebody your symptoms, they said, well, you know, sounds like this. Or they said, you know what, you need to come in. So are we going to have something like that, or is it going to be strictly you're sick and you've got to come to the clinic to find out that you're sick?
That's a very good question. The real goal is for employees and participants, including retirees, to actually physically show up at the clinic. But to answer your other question, which is the nurse line, which is something that I implemented at another jurisdiction, if you look at level 4, I'm sorry.
That
if we go to page 30.
I need a piece of paper this big to print that out.
If we go to page 30, in the green section on level 4,
and
I'm sorry if you can't read it.
You think I can read?
I'm going to explain it to you.
Okay.
But the level 4, in all seriousness, includes a nurse line. And UnitedHealthcare is offering that to the city.
Yeah, that's where I've had previous experience with it.
Correct.
Okay.
So we actually have both options. We're just tying them all together, and we're calling it the on-site clinic program. But it's really UnitedHealthcare for level 4, and level 1 and 2 is the on-site clinic itself.
Okay, so is that available? Who's that available to?
It's available to all employees, whether they're participating in our plan or not.
All right. My first part A of the question is, no matter what plan the employee chooses, they're going to have access to this so-called nurse line.
That's correct.
Okay. Now, the second part, which what that was another question of mine, we've got it's going to be available to city employees who are not participating in any one of these city plans.
That's correct.
Okay. Now, to Mrs. Koop's question, I would encourage us, while we want to do everything we can for the employees of the city, and I would advocate that even if they choose to not have insurance, they do have availability to that nurse line and the clinic. If they have other outside insurance, I think it would be short-sighted for us to not charge that in that other insurance company for the services that we're providing.
We'll ask that question as they come in.
Okay. Non-employees asked about that. Okay. I think that's got it. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Perfect. Thank you very much, Mr. Tinsky. Appreciate it. Clearly, the challenges I think everybody understands on the healthcare go way beyond the city, and not only in this region, but cities across the nation as well as businesses are dealing with the same thing. Having had a lot of experience and the same sort of frustrations over the years, the biggest thing we can do is just prevention and wellness type of thing. So the more we continue, and I think this clearly goes in that direction, but encourage as much prevention as we can, that's going to save us money in the years to come because of the self-insured nature, which in reality is the only option that we've got. I'd also comment, hopefully that clinic will be a success and really be important in reducing the cost. I know a lot of other folks have gone to that. So we appreciate it. We understand the frustration all of us have because of additional costs, and we would love to make this where the employees weren't paying anything. But I tell you, the proportion that you're doing for most businesses that are dealing with it is nothing out of the ordinary. As I said, when you weighed it, it's much closer to what other cities are doing, too. So appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Cadet, please.
I didn't know we were all through. On page 27, where you've got the employees' HRA plan, mm-hmm. is that 55% to 22%? Is that the way the plan works? They pay this much, city pays this much. And that's what it is?
No, that's not the way the 55-45 works.
Okay, explain it.
I'm going to use round numbers. It costs $100 million to provide health insurance every year. The city organization pays $55 of that million. The employees pay $45 of that million. The different categories of benefits and where the city in the different categories depends on the different plans. We pay more for the employees. We subsidize employers heavier. We do not subsidize spouses at all. So if your spouse is on here, you're paying the full freight, and we subsidize children. So you start with $100 million.